Mike Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Time for the Rick Smith Show.
I want you to get up now. I want all of you to get up out of your chairs. I want you to get up right now and go to the window, open it, and stick your head out and yell, I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore.
I don't want to abolish government. I simply want to reduce it to the size where I can drag it into the bathroom and drown in the bathtub.
You bet I cut the taxes at the top.
How dare you? How dare you? Go ahead. Make my day.
The Rick Smith Show starts now.
Welcome, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, lovers of freedom, fairness, and democracy, truth, justice, the American way. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to talk with Mike Crossey, vice president of PSEA, about their new solutions to education, some ideas on how we can improve education from the people who do education. Here's a novel concept. Why don't we ask the teachers what works instead of some bureaucrat or some administrator who probably hasn't been in a classroom in 20 years. Maybe ask the people who are actually doing the job closest to the task, how do you think we should do it? There's a novel concept. Boy, I wish I had thought of that. But we'll talk to Mike Crossey about that. Also on the program, we're going to talk with Professor Richard Wolff, a professor of economics from the University of Massachusetts, about the debt limit, the economy, where we go, how we create jobs, this whole hostage situation that the right has us under. How do we turn this thing around? We're seeing, and it's coming. We've been talking about it for a while. 1936 is upon us. We're seeing the double dip, all because of Republican ideas. Or failed ideas, if you will, back to the whole, we need more tax cuts, we need more deregulation, we need to be more business friendly. Here we are, Depression 2.0. So we'll talk about that. Also in the second hour, Scott Klingler, from the group Business for Shared Prosperity. He's their tax policy director. Going to be talking about the big anniversary tomorrow. It is a decade tomorrow that the Bush handouts happened. The first set of Bush handouts. So we'll see how did that work out for us? How did handing out all that money to the top 1%, like the Republicans are telling us we should be doing now, a decade later, how's that working out? How'd that work out for you and me? I know it worked out pretty well for the investor class. I know it worked out pretty well for the very wealthy, but how did it work out for you? How did it work out for me? I'm saying we've already had our lost decade for you and me. The investor class, they did very well, thank you very much. That little blip on the screen that, you know, cost you and I millions of jobs was just a blip on their screen. The wealth is back, the bonuses are back, the high pay is back, stocks are back, everything's back, except for the employment, except for the wages for you and me. So we'll talk about that. In the third hour, we're gonna try and get someone from Walkerville, out in Wisconsin. They're setting up tents on the Capitol. Capitol steps out in the lawn. Again, it's about the budget. Budgets across this country. You're seeing people getting to the streets, getting to their Capitol. I'm hoping here we're going to see more of that. Last week's budget push really just about screwing people. So we're going to talk about all that stuff. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Well, the big news today, evidently it is Wiener's Wiener. And again, I don't care. You know, the whole idea that, oh, well, you know, so it was him. He's not a guy who runs on this, so it's not important to me. If he were a Democrat who said, you know, I'm a family values guy, and, you know, those people who do this or that, you know, stick it to them, then I would be hammering him. He's not one of those guys who, hey, look at me. I'm of great moral fiber. I don't see him that way. Granted, he, you know, he says, oh, I did the horrible thing. I don't care. Is he dumb? Yes. My grandfather was right from the beginning. You never write anything down, and you definitely never let anybody take pictures of you doing anything that you don't want me to see. You know, and again, you know, my grandfather always said, you know, don't do the wrong thing. Don't get caught doing the wrong thing. And once I said, well, how do I know if I'm doing the wrong thing? You know, to me, it may be okay. He goes, and this is pretty good advice to live by. He says, if you're looking over your shoulder to see if your mother's watching you, you're not doing the right thing. And that's a pretty good way to live. And, you know, I got to be honest, taking pictures of myself naked to send out to girls across the – mom probably wouldn't like that. Probably wouldn't have been on board with it. The other big news, more big news, Tricky Ricky Santorum, he has thrown the proverbial hat in the ring. Mr. We're going to make America – America again. He is now pledging his unflinching commitment to conservative policies, including Medicare reform. So we're going after Granny. He says we're going to be in it. We're going to be in this race, and we're going to win it. I would want no politician to enter the race. And you know what? I just thought it'd be a good idea, but we're going to lose. So, you know. We're in it to just kind of make a name for himself so I can get a think tank job down the road, which is what he's just trying to get himself a cabinet position. He doesn't stand a snowball's chance in Hades. He's got a better chance of being president than Sarah Palin has of actually getting a multiple guess history question right. Also, he has blamed the president. Our buddy Tricky Ricky has blamed the president for the devaluing of our currency. And gee, Wow, I thought that was the Bush years, but he says Obama has devalued our currency. He's devalued our culture, debased our dollars and our moral currency. Again, you know, got to get that whole moral high ground, that whole hooray for me. You know, look at me, the good social conservative. When the reality is if you look at the numbers and if you look at what's going on, September 2008, it was to the basement. Now, remember, when Little Shrub took over, we were doing pretty well. The economy was steaming along. Things were going well. And then a straight beeline downward. Obama brought us back out of this. Republican obstructionism has dropped us back in, and we are double-dipping. There is no question about it. The numbers are there. The graphing is there. We are back in the middle of it. And again, it's this whole belief that we need to cut at a time when we're spiraling downward, which can only take us deeper downward. When you're cutting those jobs that, oh, I don't know, helped buoy up the economy, you know, those public workers who make about $34,000 a year with a little health care and a little pension, you know, those greedy people who make too much money. I don't think $34,000 is all that much, but that's what the average state worker makes. When you start taking those jobs away, there's a real problem in your economy. And that's what we're seeing. That is absolutely what we're seeing. Also here in Harrisburg, they're back. Yeah, they had their whole week off. It was kind of a tour they did. The patting themselves on the back. I'm calling it the restoring money to the education tour. They, you know, went around and say, look at us, pat us on the back. We kept that $27.3 billion that the governor wanted, and we stole from those old people, and we did all those things. But we're back. You know, they cut health care for seniors. They cut the programs for people with disabilities. And don't forget the 40-some thousand people that we kicked off of adult basic. Don't forget that. But, you know, I get it. You know, they made their point. They made the case. The conservatives have done it. Times are tough. We're broke. Right? We're broke. Times are tough. There's not enough money in the pot. We had 109 Republicans who voted in the House to pit Granny against the kindergartners and that poor woman we met in the wheelchair against that college kids, because times are tough. Yet you look at a special report done by the Bucks County Courier-Times, which points out that the Senate's choices for health care include a medical and drug plan that costs more than $30,000 per employee, with you and me picking up nearly all of the premiums for the 360 employees enrolled. And as for the House, their choices of the family plan cost more than $20,000, including a drug benefit. Yet all I heard on the right-wing radio this past week is how those greedy teachers and those greedy state workers, how they're not paying the same as we are. They're paying, but not the same as we are, because we're the ones who are being tortured here. But no real talk of the folks there in the legislature. And you hear this thing, this shared sacrifice, and I got to go, really? I'm not seeing the sharing. And if you read Sunday's Harrisburg Patriot News, which pretty much has laid out the beginning of this push, because it's going to be this intense push to get the budget done. It points out, the big headline read, as Corbett pushes sacrifice, where's his? The governor wants to cut school funding. He wants to cut higher ed. He wants to cut salaries of public employees, yet he took a $30,000 raise. And as the Patriot pointed out, he also bought four brand spanking new SUVs to transport himself as lieutenant governor and their wives around at a cost of about $187,000. So times are tough, I know. Can't get mama, you go. Sorry, can't do that. She needs to be wrapped around in style. You know, because the job numbers last week were so good that we have all this money available to buy four brand new SUVs. And look, I'm in favor of buying new SUVs. The auto industry needs the work, and I'm in favor of that. But sorry, not when you're cutting Granny, not when you're kicking people off the programs. Sorry, not going to go there with you. So, again, you know, what we're seeing is this whole push. The right wing's doing a nice job. Got to give them credit. Still pushing that government run like a business. Got to run that government like a business. So when we have a downturn, we kick all those employees to the street and make it worse. And they're doing a good job of that. So when times are tough, we cut. And does that make any sense to you? It doesn't make any sense to me, but to them it does. Because they've got this business mentality. They don't understand that government is there regardless. You're still going to need your trash picked up. You're still going to need Granny taken care of. You're still going to need that stuff. You still need to educate those children. Those children. Why do we have to do that? Why don't we just let education crumble like we've done to our roads and bridges? Sounds like a great idea. If we divest completely, we don't have to worry about it. Wonderful stuff. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'm going to talk with Mike Crossey, Vice President of the PSEA, the Pennsylvania State Education Association, right back after this.
It's not right wing, just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Organizers of a labor rally in Erie, Pennsylvania on Saturday intended to show solidarity between unions currently in negotiations with General Electric. They expected more than 1,000 workers to show up, but when more than 3,000 filled the Hammer Mill Center at Gannon University, the organizers said they were surprised. 10 unions have been in negotiations with GE since May 23rd. The current contract offered by GE would end the defined pension plan for new hires and implement a health care plan that doubles the cost for workers. Outside of the contract, another issue that was highlighted at Saturday's rally was GE's profit-making while not paying taxes. According to a recent report in New York Times, GE saw $14.2 billion in worldwide profits in 2010, with $5.1 billion thanks to U.S. operations. GE reported that it only paid 7.4% in taxes on those U.S. profits. What GE pays in taxes is barely a third of the average of other major corporations. Further upsetting workers is that GE has reduced U.S. employment by 22,000 jobs since 2007, even while President Barack Obama has tapped GE chief executive Jeffrey Immelt as U.S. job czar. Meanwhile, a couple states away in Wisconsin, Walkerville returned to the capital. Walkerville is a tent city of sorts that originally popped up during the first 30 days of protests at the Wisconsin Capitol. This week, Walkerville returned, surrounding the Capitol, to protest the governor's deep budget cuts. Doug Cunningham spoke with some of the first residents of this new Walkerville.
Betsy Kippers, vice president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, was one of the first people setting up tents in Walkerville.
Since we are no longer able to voice our protests inside the Capitol building, we decided to set out a tent city outside the building to make sure people are hearing our voices against Governor Walker's budget, which is being dealt with this week. So we are going to be out here until the budget is done, and we are going to have our voices heard about the damage that Governor Walker is doing to the citizens of this state with his budget.
Beth McClure was erecting a tent with her husband and two small children.
Close to $800 million of education cuts are a real concern for us. Medicaid cuts, the national level, the conversation about Medicare. I just hope that this brings more attention to the issues of income inequality and the fact that we as a country have decided to give benefits to wealthy corporations and wealthy individuals while middle class and working class people are paying for the Great Recession.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Standing up to conservatives and corporatists every weeknight, The Rick Smith Show.
I'm just an average man with an average life. I work from 9 to 5. Hey, hell, I pay the price. All I want is to be left alone in my average home. But why do I always feel like I'm in the twilight zone? And I always feel like somebody's watching me.
So today, the governor gave a commencement address. He was down in Philadelphia at the Boys Latin Charter School. This is their first graduating class. And congratulations to them. You got to give them credit where credit is due. But here's the problem. The problem is last year, this graduating class, last year as 11th graders, the folks at the Boys Latin Charter School, they didn't do so well. In fact, 91% of them were below grade level in math, and you had 80% of them below grade level in reading, yet here they are graduating. And, you know, the more I see this kind of stuff, the more I have to agree with Patrick Paolini, the guy who's vice president and general manager of Fox 29 in Philadelphia. When talking about SB1, he said this.
SB1 is not a perfect bill, nor will it fix our failing school system.
But he thinks we should do it anyway. Instead of going, you know, how do we fix the entire system for everybody so it works for everyone? How do we make sure that public education is the best quality education that we can possibly get for everybody? How would we do that? Maybe ask people who actually do it for a living? That'd be a good start, don't you think? We haven't tried it before. Maybe we could try it this time. That's why I've got Mike Crossey on the line. He's the vice president of the PSEA, PSEA.org. They have come out with solutions that work. Solutionsthatwork, PA.org is the website if you want to check that out. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
It's a pleasure to be with you always, Rick, and thank you for that setup. You know, I hear that all the time. We know it doesn't work, but let's do it anyway because it's a change. And that was one of the reasons why, with Jim Testerman as our president and, all of the research and all of the professionals we have across the state, we decided to put together a program, Solutions That Work, and say, if we have struggling schools, and we do, we have 144 school buildings in the state of Pennsylvania that students are not achieving where we need them to be. The vast majority of our schools across the state of Pennsylvania work very, very well.
How many buildings do we have across the state?
That I don't know. We have 499 districts. You know, that's got to be, you know, several thousand buildings.
So to look at 144 out of what has to be somewhere in the 4,000 or 5,000 range, Right. Not a huge percentage, so why would we throw away the baby with the bathwater?
That's exactly what we're saying. But that seems to be where the rhetoric is, and that seems to be where the rhetoric resonates across the state. So we've talked about it, and we've said, let's come out with a program that says this is what works. And I know when I've been debating the Senate Bill 1, I've said, you know, let's not destroy the public education system. Let's take a look at the schools where students aren't succeeding, where the students are still dropping out at too high a rate, and let's fix those buildings. That's what we need to do. And, you know, so it's a matter of, you know, somebody said to me, it was a great analogy. Somebody gave it to me. I can't take credit for it. They said, if you get a flat tire, you don't throw the car out.
Right.
You know, you fix the flat tire. And that's kind of where we are with our school systems. You know, and I think I've said this before on your show, Pennsylvania is number one in the nation in eighth grade reading. And we're in the top 10 in fourth grade, and we're the top 10 in math. And again, both at the fourth and the eighth grade level, 70% of our students go on to higher education. For the most part, our schools do a great job. But for those places that don't, some of our suggestions are investing in early childhood education, authorizing site-based decision-makings for those schools where students are struggling to succeed, creating additional learning time for students who are not proficient. Let me give you a perfect example of that. We did that in my district. My district is a good district. It's a successful district. We have very few students dropping out. But we still have some students who are struggling. And one of the issues we found was that a lot of our students who are not struggling were also involved in the juvenile justice system. And when we talked to our magistrate about it, I said, you know, when they have to go to a hearing, you know, they have another whole day of school. They're not learning that day again. He said, let's come up with a solution and to bring court to school. So once a month, he holds court in school. Instead of the students missing a full day of school, they miss about a 40-minute period that they're actually hearing. Then they come right back to school. And so all of a sudden, those students have one more day of school under their belts. It's a simple thing. It doesn't cost anybody any money, but it's a matter of us sharing responsibility with law enforcement and social service agencies to address students that are at risk.
Right.
You know, providing all students a full range of opportunities to prepare them for work and post-secondary education. Perfect example of that is we need to shore up and invest in our technical schools, our career and technical education programs. You know, every child's not going to go to college. Every child's not going to be a doctor. But my God, we need plumbers and carpenters and electricians out there. And those are just.
Do you think a part of this has to do with
involvement programs? Those kind of programs work as a classroom teacher.
All circuits are busy. Please.
Oh, I guess we lost Mike there. the wonders of working with cell phones. But, you know, you look at this, and he made a lot of very good points. You look at the fact that you're talking about getting kids into school more, bringing the judge in, having the judge there on site. So the kid misses a couple of minutes. He gets you know, the thing taken care of. He's back in class. For me, one of the big things, and if we can get him back on the line, that I want to talk about is, weekend school, after school programs to keep kids out of trouble so they don't get into the juvenile system. To me, that's part of the big problem here is that you've got so many kids who are missing school, who don't have the opportunity to be in class. And the other part of it is giving them something to do after school and on weekends. Mike, thanks for coming back. I don't know what happened there.
No, I don't either. I'm, I got a night off. I'm done with my meetings. I'm just sitting here at the dining room table, so I'm not sure what happened.
All circuits were busy, evidently, according to Verizon. But, you know, what I was saying while you were gone is that one of the things that I want to see is in those areas, those 144 buildings across the state, that very small number of schools, where I think are in poverty-ridden areas, and you've probably got better numbers than I do, but having grown up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland, I understand the culture there. So what I would like to see is, you know, longer days, weekends, things that occupy time to keep kids out of the justice system, keeping them out of that courtroom so that you don't have to even bring the judge in anymore.
Wow, that would certainly be ideal. Any kind of program you know, one of the things I've often advocated, it's not in our solution, is at work. But, you know, the school should be the center of the community. And you're right. The more we involve kids, extracurricular activities, after-school tutoring programs, we know that more kids get in trouble between the school bell and the dinner bell than at any other time during the day. You know, and the more we can do sharing things with the community, working with local policymakers to create after-school programs that are good, productive programs that get kids involved, whether it's sports or arts or academics, you know, the more positively we can find ways to involve the kids and engage, the less trouble we're going to have in the community.
Right.
And the kids need to see that there's a future out there. They need to see that there's a hope and there's a reason to stay in school. And when the streets look more glamorous than the future they see in school, they're going to choose the streets, and we have to convince them that the better route is to stay in school and to become successful that way.
Yep.
But you're right. Most of our struggling schools are in poorer communities, and you know, so it's not just a matter. Again, I'm speaking outside of my Solutions That Worked program, but most of our schools, you know, are in impoverished areas, and we need to address poverty. We need to address jobs.
Yep. You know, one of the things I gave George H.W. Bush credit for was his midnight basketball program, and he took a lot of beating off, a lot of beating over that. But, you know, the reality is it gave kids something to do. And the more you can do that, the more, and I would love to see if there was some research done at how many of those kids then went on to finish school and stayed out of trouble. I would love to see that. Anyway, let's get back to this Solutions at Work, because I want to run through some of the other things, because I think there's some very good ideas here. Run me back through them again.
Sure. Well, there's high expectations for all students, proven practices that support student learning, investing in early childhood education, site-based decision-making, additional learning time for students who are not proficient, mentoring programs between elementary school and middle school and between middle school and high school. That's where we lose a lot of kids. They get lost kind of in that transition phase. We need to make sure that that's not happening. And we need to provide all students a full range of opportunities to prepare them for work and for post-secondary schooling. We need to look at parents by establishing district programs that promote and encourage parents, families, communities to get involved and get engaged in their schools. You know, for our students who are English language learners, we need to set up a system that their parents feel welcomed in our schools, so we translate those programs for them. You know, in a lot of these schools where the kids are considered failing kids, it's because they're passed in English, but they can't read. Well, I'm reasonably intelligent, and, you know, but what if you ask me to take a test in Spanish, I'm going to fail it.
Yep.
Or in Greek, I'm going to fail it. Or in Japanese, I'm going to fail it. You know, does that make me a failure? I don't think so. And a lot of these kids that have been labeled failing by the system are not failing kids. They need to work with English language learners in a way that we've never done before. We need to provide the resources that students need to achieve, whether they're struggling students, whether they're special ed students, whether they're English language learners students. We also need to strengthen the coordination with law enforcement and social service agencies to address students who are at risk. We need to have alternative classrooms for students who are disruptive or potentially violent. You know, one of the things we found is that in some of the schools, struggling schools, there's also a higher level of violence, a higher level of truancy, a higher level of disruptions. We need to work with those kind of programs and create those kind of systems that have to happen so that every child has a chance to succeed.
I'm right there with you.
We need to create a culture that, you know, rumors, threats, bullying, abusive behavior, none of that stuff is acceptable in our schools. And we should need to ensure that our buildings meet minimum standards of cleanliness and safety. You know, so we know that that's going to mean a lot of conversations. Our Solutions at Work isn't 100% finished yet. You know, we're working with the Department of Education to create a new evaluation system. We know that, you know, one of the most important things in any school building is a high-quality teacher in every classroom. We need to make sure that if we have a struggling teacher, there's a program there to support them, make sure that they're being the best they can be, and they become the best they can be. We need to make sure that newer teachers have supports and mentoring and make those kind of things link them to professional development. So there's lots of things we can do. Some cost money, some don't. But, you know, when we're talking about money, we need to talk to the governor and the legislature into, you know,
into committing to it. What scares me, Mike, is that we're going to see education crumble like we've seen our infrastructure crumble through lack of investment. The fact that we haven't been keeping up for the last generation with our infrastructure, and we're seeing, we're now, I guess, reaping the reward of that with a crumbling infrastructure. I worry that in 5-10 years down the road, this kind of lack of investment is going to lead to a crumbling education system, and we're, as a nation, going to fall further behind and further behind countries who value education.
Right. You're 100% right on that. And, you know, and if you buy the governor's argument that his budget was built around the revenue that he had available, which is what he said, he said, I'm not going in the hole. I'm going to base my budget based on the revenue we have. Well, fortunately, the economy has started to pick up a little bit. The governor has $536 million more dollars than when he released his budget on March the 8th. We need to take that $536 million and restore some of these programs that we know work in our schools and restore some of these programs so that the kids are not getting hurt.
Yep. Because, you know, here's the thing. And the other part of this is we're not talking about revenue enhancements. We're not talking about even looking at taxing the drillers who are taking billions of dollars of wealth from under our feet. We're not talking about closing the laundering system that goes through a Delaware PO box and scrubs all those profits clean from the state of Pennsylvania so that corporations don't have to pay any tax here. We're not talking about that.
Oh, and we should be. You know, we're fully on board with that. I truly believe that we need to make our tax system in Pennsylvania fair. You know, big oil should be paying its fair share, as you mentioned, with the Marcellus shale drillers. Big business should be paying its fair share with the Delaware loophole. You and I pay more taxes than 80% of the corporations in the state of Pennsylvania. That's not fair to the average citizen. And, you know, big tobacco should be paying its fair share. We're the only state in the nation that doesn't tax smokeless tobacco and cigars. And, you know, so you're right. There are revenue enhancements out there, and I'm really not shy about saying we ought to go after that money because it's there and our kids deserve it.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Mike Crossey, Vice President of the PSEA, PSEA.org. They got a website, solutionsthatworkpa.org. We're going to put a link at our site at thericksmithshow.com so you can check out this solutions that work idea and judge for yourself. Mike, thanks for your time. I appreciate it. Keep up the fight on behalf of children.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to be with you, Rick.
All righty. We're going to take a quick break. Back with your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
This is why we fight. Why we violate. This is why we fight.
Finally, radio for the rest of us. Rick Smith.
In an astonishing observation, Representative Paul Ryan recently declared, Washington has not been honest with you. Gosh, Paul, that possibility never occurred to us. What makes Ryan's observation astonishing is the fact that he is Washington, a 7-term Republican insider, House budget chairman, and author of the GOP's ideologically contrived budget-whacking plan that kills America's enormously popular Medicare program. But Ryan didn't mean to point his finger at himself. No, no, he meant those dastardly Democrats who dared to tell the public about his proposal to replace Medicare with a privatized voucher scheme. Understandably, the public is now angry at Ryan and his Republican cohorts. Hence, he is scurrying around in a shamefully dishonest PR campaign to accuse the Democrats of, what else, dishonesty. The Ryan plan, he asserts, would give seniors, quote, the same kind of health insurance system members of Congress enjoy today. Oh, Paul, pants on fire. We taxpayers cover 75% of the payments for the plan that you enjoy. But you would saddle older folks with vouchers that would cover only a third of their insurance costs, and that share would shrink with each passing year. Apparently, feeling that telling the truth is unfair in today's politics, Republicans are angry at Democrats for talking about Ryan's Medicare gut job. Senator John Cornyn, the Texas Republican whose sweeping white pompadour covers a totally empty head, recently ranted in feigned outrage that Democrats are trying to scare the daylights out of seniors. "I think that's irresponsible," he bellowed, oblivious to his own absurd scare tactics of only 2 years ago when he assailed Obamacare, direly warning that Obama was turning Medicare into, quote, a health care gulag. This is Jim Hightower saying, Republicans can run all they want, but on this one, they can't hide.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
I'm ready to do what has to be done for the next generation, with the courage to fight for freedom, with the courage to fight for America. That's why I'm announcing today that I'm running for president.
And when you look so tall and you're alone, how many nights you sit beside the phone? What were the things you wanted for yourself? Teenage ambitions you remember well.
Yes. The heat of the moment there, Tricky Ricky. You know, whenever I think of Tricky Ricky, I think of the last time when he was running for Senate. I just can't get this clip out of my head.
What I'm asking all of you tonight is not to put on a uniform, put on a bumper sticker. Is it that much to ask? Is it that much to ask to step up and serve your country?
Serve your country by putting a bumper sticker. I think of that often, but that's his, in his mind, that's how you serve your country. Kind of odd, don't you think, Jake?
If you remember, Rick, he went off the deep end. If you remember, he said the fate of our nation was at stake. And if we elected Bob Casey, it would be very, very, very detrimental, and our security would be at risk. I guess he saw the polls and thought he needed a grand slam. Well, he struck out on that one and lost, going away by an amazing 17 points, which is huge in political circles.
Yeah. John Boehner's spokesperson, Brandon Buck, his name is, said the administration's auto bailout is nothing to celebrate. He said the model the White House should be touting is Ford, which instead of relying on a taxpayer-funded bailout, saw trouble coming and made the tough decisions necessary to preserve jobs and weather the storm. Here's the problem with that, you know, that rewrite of history. Had they let the other two collapse, all the feeders into Ford would have collapsed along with it, and Ford would have gone down the drain. You would have had a giant sucking sound, and it would have been the sucking sound of jobs lost, which is what the Southern Republicans wanted. They wanted the death of the U.S. automakers so that the Southern companies could grow and expand. Understand that where their allegiance lies. Their allegiance lies to their workers. And yes, those foreign companies may have expanded some of the production there. I doubt it. I really doubt it. And the guy from the Cato Institute that I debated last week, he said, well, you know, they would have still used those plants. You probably would have had Southern companies coming in, maybe, using those facilities. I doubt it. Again, you know, this is hope. This is pray. This is, oh, this may have been. This is the model. This is how capitalism works. Understand, this guy works for John Boehner, who said, you know, if people lose their jobs, so be it. Who are pushing these policies that are costing us tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of public sector jobs. And I don't care what your thoughts are. There's still jobs that are paying taxes back into the local community. There's still jobs that are supporting families.
But it's my money. Hey, me.
We need services. We need things done. It's amazing. But here's the thing. Ford, according to the Wall Street Journal, will benefit from many of the concessions that GM and Chrysler exacted from their suppliers, from the unions, from the debt holders, from the dealers, all of them. So part of Ford's success is tied to what happened with GM and Chrysler. Now, look, at the end of the day, like The Economist said, the magazine The Economist, the doomsdayers were wrong. And right now you've got the right who's working overtime, trying to figure out how to spin this because it is creating jobs, it is growing, it is supporting communities and families, it is. And, you know, even though last week's labor numbers came in only 54,000 jobs created, what the important number is were the almost 30,000 public sector jobs that were canned through legislatures like here, through the Scott Walkers and the Kasichs and all of these people going after public workers. And the Daryl Issas of the world who want to put forth a jobs plan that cuts hundreds of thousands of public sector jobs with this bizarre idea that somehow those are going to be picked up by the private sector and those workers will go into the private sector and, of course, lower the wages because you have an influx of labor. So you've now got a glut, an even larger glut of labor, which will drive the price of wages down even further, more corporate profits. And what we're seeing is we are seeing Republican nirvana. This is mission accomplished. This is the utopia that they dreamed of. They've got the president kind of on the ropes. Understand, their commitment is to make Obama a one-term president regardless of the consequences. No matter what happens, their goal is to take him down. And if that means taking the country with him, that's what they're going to do. Because remember, go back to the recovery bill. Go back and see what they pushed for. They pushed for high tax cuts for the very wealthy, and Obama gave in and gave tax cuts to 95% of the people in the country. Give him credit for fighting for that, but they also killed the Buy American provision. If you remember, the Republicans were out front on this. Oh, we can't have that. And look at what happened to the auto industry. We've got Republicans who have pursued policies that would ultimately benefit these foreign corporations. By taking down the auto industry, it benefits Volkswagen in Tennessee, and it benefits Mercedes in Alabama. Doesn't help the American auto worker. I mean, what we're seeing is 1936.2, another Republican-led debacle. And what are their policies? What are their plans to get us out of this? How do we grow out of this? How do we get out of this double-dip recession? Well, the same thing that got us into it, according to them. We need more tax cuts. More tax cuts for the wealthy. More tax cuts for corporations. You betcha. Deregulate. Yeah, we got to get rid of those regulations. Oh, get rid of them. And, of course, more free trade schemes that allow us to ship more jobs overseas. That's what we need. How many people remember November and December of 2010? Remember the last time the Republicans held the nation hostage? Remember that? It was all about the Bush handouts. We got to extend the Bush handouts. In fact, they wanted it permanent. They wanted it forever, till the end of time. Obama agreed for 2 more years. So we needed these handouts to make the uber wealthy uber, uber wealthy. And, of course, you know, make sure that the uber wealthy's great, 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 great grandchildren have a tidy sum by making sure that the estate tax didn't harm the very wealthy. Again, another payoff for the investor class, for the wealth class. We never hear about that on fake news on Fox. No. It's all about, oh, he's paying back those labor unions. I'm sorry, but we gave a couple $1 trillion away to the top 2%. Sorry, missing that. And now you got Tricky Ricky Santorum saying the president has devalued our currency. No, that happened during the Shrub years, especially when we allowed these massive trade deficits to take place. So now you got all these American companies who have left the country. They're gone. And one of the things that I didn't really think of until I talked to a friend of mine who's a financial manager, a financial planner, my buddy Mike Avis, he said the U.S. Chamber, the International Chamber of Commerce, you know, my favorite GOP terrorist group, them, their cronies, their co-conspirators in the GOP, they've been pushing this idea of foreign profit repatriation. Have a tax holiday to bring back those profits. Have a tax holiday. Because, of course, they're sitting on tons of cash. There's all this money over there, all this cash in those companies overseas. If we could just bring that back. But here's the thing. They're already sitting on mountains of cash and not hiring. If we bring in more cash, do you think they're going to hire? No. They're going to sit on that. They're going to hand it out in bigger bonuses. And you and I are not going to benefit from this. That's the gig, man. That's the gig, Jake.
Well, again, I mean, they blame Obama, and yet you have people who I respect, Bill Clinton, who you can say what you want of him, but he's brilliant, and he claims there's $3 trillion out there between the banks and corporate America. $3 trillion, and can you imagine the stimulus if they would invest that in the economy? We don't have a lack of money. We have a lack of commitment. And we have skewed priorities.
We need a tax code to go get that money back. That's what we need.
Absolutely.
Anyway, let's take a quick break. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
You've reached Jenny in the accounts receivable department of Den Supply International. I can't come to the phone right now. Please leave a message and I'll return your call as soon as I'm available.
Jenny was in constant pain and missing too much work.
I wasn't reliable. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't be what I wanted to be. I knew that I could do my job better. I knew that I could be a better mom. I could be a better wife. But my body wasn't letting me.
Fortunately, Jenny's employer has Capital Blue Cross. And Capital gave Jenny a whole set of services called Better Health Works. Jenny filled out a profile, got online coaching, and called a nurse line.
She talked me out of a very dark time because I didn't know what else to do. Since I had my surgery, now I can give my employer and my family 110% of me.
Capital's Amy Montgomery is happy that Jenny is happy.
It feels great that Capital Blue Cross was able to help Jenny this way.
We really believe in what we do, and I think that that's one of the things that makes us successful. I think it's a perfect example of when you care more, you do more.
Capital Blue Cross is an independent licensee of the Blue Cross Blue Shield Association.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
PSECU, we know those holiday bills can really pile up and hit you with double-digit interest rates or fees that start to snowball. Next thing you know, you're buried in a mountain of debt. Dig out by using our 3.9 annual percentage rate Visa balance transfer. Good through December 31st, 2012. That's a really big deal. And you heard that right. Our really big deal, 3.9% APR, is good through December 31st, 2012. And we don't charge you a balance transfer fee. So if you used any other credit card to pay for your holiday purchases, move those high interest rate balances to your PSECU Visa. The sooner you get in on this really big deal, the more you'll save. Financing Life is what we do best. Talk with us. Call 800-LOAN-555 or go to pscc.com/life. Get in on a really big deal Visa balance transfer. Don't wait. Start saving.
This credit union is federally insured by the National Credit Union Administration. Equal opportunity lender.
Exposing that free trade is never free. The Rick Smith Show.
Everybody's got a price. Everybody's gonna pay. There's the $1 million man. Always, it's his way.
I like it. I like it. The $1 million man always gets his way. The Koch brothers always get their way. I don't know if you saw in the paper this past Sunday in the Patriot News. There was a story in there about the Patriot Act. And there's a kid, a local kid, who it caught my eye that he is the Koch Summer Fellow at George Mason University. So the Koch brothers have, you know, given this kid a couple of bucks there at George Mason, who has a fairly, an extremely conservative policy institute that the Koch brothers fund. So evidently this kid's going to be part of that. But he's talking about the Patriot Act that just kind of caught my eye. And I question, where were these people back when we were originally debating the Patriot Act? These right wingers, you never heard a peep out of them. They were all in for, yes, gonna go get those terrorists. Yet someone like me who back in the day when we were arguing this said, hold on, maybe we should slow down a little bit, was called anti-American. But now that Obama's president, what they're doing, and again, it's a beautiful rewrite of history. They're going to make this Obama's. You watch. In a couple of years, you're going to hear it's Obama's Patriot Act because, of course, he's the one who has extended it. And, you know, they're making Rand Paul out to be this grand hero who wanted to single-handedly filibuster. He wanted to be Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and he wanted to be the one to hold it up. I wish a whole bunch of them would have held it up. This is scary stuff. It's been scary stuff for years. But again, you know, now the right-wingers are involved, and the Koch brothers have funded a spokesperson, so he gets a nice piece right there on the front of the review and opinion page. And good for him. You know, he's going to need a job at some point. Our Borowitz report from Andy Borowitz, the headline reads, Paul Ryan vows to continue Kevorkian's work. Last week, Mr. Kevorkian passed away. And in his honor, they wrote this piece. In a somber congressional ceremony, Representative Paul Ryan eulogized the late Dr. Jack Kevorkian, vowing to honor his legacy by continuing his good work. Paul Ryan said Dr. Kevorkian tried to ease the transition for seniors into the great beyond. Here in Congress, we have the opportunity, one might even say the obligation, to continue Kevorkian's work on a grander scale. As a first step to memorialize the work of Dr. Kevorkian, Representative Ryan said that his new budget plan would replace Medicare with a system of so-called vouchers that could be redeemed for cyanide pills, nooses, and bullets. In other political news, Anthony Weiner suffered another setback in the form of harsh words and criticism from Bill Clinton, who said, in my day, we'd show it to him in person. The avalanche of ridicule suffered by Representative Weiner in recent days finally drew some pushback from members of Congress. The new Weiner spokesperson, Hugh G. Rection, said, it's time for all of these babyish Wiener jokes to stop. Everywhere a new study shows that when you talk on your cell phone, everyone around you can hear every word you say. So there you go. Tomorrow, the big news tomorrow. What's tomorrow, Jake?
Tomorrow is a rally over the Capitol.
There is a rally over the Capitol for the Marcellus Shale. It's also the 10th anniversary of the Economic Growth and Tax Relief Reconciliation Act of 2001. This, my friends, the first of the Bush handouts. 10 years ago tomorrow, we will have handed out a whole bunch of money, and it accompanied the worst economic expansion since World War II. Now, remember, the little shrub said, you know, we're going to give out $550 billion in across-the-board tax cuts. Across the board. Going to create a million new jobs. Going to do it. We're going to create a million new jobs. It didn't happen. Sorry, just plain didn't happen. Wanted it to. Planned for it to. Didn't happen. But again, you know, the reality is the right will do a nice job of trying to rewrite history. Instead of, you know, and I love playing this clip because the reality is the little shrub said it.
With a robust package of at least $550 billion in across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than a million new jobs.
Yes, sir. Yes, did it happen? No, didn't happen. But here are some interesting numbers from the people over at the EPI. In 2010, the top 1% of earners, those are people making over $645,000 a year, they received 38% of the tax breaks. 38% from 2001 to 2008. 55% of all the tax breaks went to the top 10%, those people making over 170 grand a year. Now, the tippy top, the top of the top, that top 0.1%, those folks making $3 million a year, these are not the capital gains people. No, no, these are people who actually go to, you know, they actually have jobs that pay them salaries of $3 million a year. I know it's hard to believe, but there are some. They got an average tax cut of $520,000. Which, I got to be honest, is more than 450 times more than I got or any of the other average middle-class families in this country. And you look at the fact that the vast majority of this money went right to the top. And yet we are still defending tax breaks for the very wealthy. Did it create jobs? Did it do what the little shrub said it was going to do?
With a robust package of at least $550 billion and across-the-board tax relief, we will help create more than a million new jobs.
And the answer is no, it didn't. What it did do is it drained our coffers. It put us into debt. It made us go borrow money at a time of war. The second set of Bush tax cuts, the second set of handouts, we're at a time of war. Never in the history of civilization has there ever been a tax cut during a time of war. Yet, thanks to the shrub, we have undone you thousands of years of history.
No, and you're forgetting one thing, too, we didn't pay for. It wasn't just the wars and it wasn't just the tax cuts. It was that prescription drug. Medicare, that's another one.
Another handout.
Thanks to the Republicans. That was a super, super gift.
And now the reality is here we are. What I'm saying is already the lost decade. We've already lost from 2001 to 2011 because wage increases for working people just haven't happened. In fact, we've seen money taking away. But what they're saying, and CBS had an interesting piece on this, saying that, you know, we've got chronic unemployment that's worse than the Great Depression because people have been out of work longer than they were even back then because they can't find new work. And what's interesting is employers, if you're someone who's been out of work for 6, 8 months, 10 months, 2 years, there's no employer going to hire you. They're not going to get into that, especially if you're in an area where new jobs are coming in. So, you know, you look at this and you go, well, how do you get out of this? How should we have done this? And I said from the beginning, 26 weeks unemployment, government becomes the employer of last resort. You get people doing something productive. And that's my problem.
And again, counter to what the Republicans, the message, the Republicans, they're acting like, well, you give these people unemployment. You're kind of throwing it down a rat hole. No. There's a multiplier. There is an absolute multiplier for each dollar that you give on unemployment. The last numbers I saw, I think the multiplier is like 1.2. You create about $1.20 in the economy. Because why? Because if you're unemployed, you're going to spend that money. It's going to go back into the economy, help stimulate the economy. It's that simple. It is an economic incentive.
And at the end of this, you know, all we keep hearing from the radical right, all we keep hearing is we need more spending cuts. And all we hear from a state legislature here, like Scott Perry here in our area, we need to have unemployment harder to get. We need less generous benefits. We need to recalculate it for less benefits. We need to do all these things to make it harder to get and make it less. Basically taking from you and me, and I go, you know, at a time of massive crisis, you're really going to want to steal from people in their hour of need? Really? Is that your value? Wow. Is that family values? Is that moral values? And the answer is no. What that is that's greed. That's kowtowing to corporate America. That's what that is.
I'll tell you what they do. They demagogue it when they talk about unemployment people not wanting to take jobs that are there. They'll see a sign up for a couple weeks, maybe at a Turkey Hill, and say, see, we told you people don't want to work. They don't want to work. I would like to know where these jobs are that people aren't taking. Where are they?
Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk with our good friend, Professor Richard Wolff. We're right back after this.
Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
You're listening to Win, the
the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Organizers of a labor rally in Erie, Pennsylvania on Saturday intended to show solidarity between unions currently in negotiations with General Electric. They expected more than 1,000 workers to show up, but when more than 3,000 filled the Hammermill Center at Gannon University, the organizers said they were surprised. 10 unions have been in negotiations with GE since May 23rd. The current contract offered by GE would end the defined pension plan for new hires and implement a health care plan that doubles the cost for workers. Outside of the contract, another issue that was highlighted at Saturday's rally was GE's profit making while not paying taxes. According to a recent report in New York Times, GE saw $14.2 billion in worldwide profits in 2010, with $5.1 billion thanks to U.S. operations. GE reported that it only paid 7.4% in taxes on those U.S. profits. What GE pays in taxes is barely a third of the average of other major corporations. Further upsetting workers is that GE has reduced U.S. employment by 22,000 jobs since 2007, even while President Barack Obama has tapped GE chief executive Jeffrey Immelt as U.S. job czar. Meanwhile, a couple states away in Wisconsin, Walkerville returned to the Capitol. Walkerville is a tent city of sorts that originally popped up during the first 30 days of protests at the Wisconsin Capitol. This week, Walkerville returned, surrounding the Capitol, to protest the governor's deep budget cuts. Doug Cunningham spoke with some of the first residents of this new Walkerville.
Betsy Kippers, vice president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, was one of the first people setting up tents in Walkerville.
Since we are no longer able to voice our protests inside the Capitol building, we decided to set out a tent city outside the building to make sure people are hearing our voices against Governor Walker's budget, which is being dealt with this week. So we are going to be out here until the budget is done, and we are going to have our voices heard about the damage that Governor Walker is doing to the citizens of this state with his budget.
Beth McClure was erecting a tent with her husband and two small children.
Close to $800 million of education cuts are a real concern for us. Medicaid cuts, the national level, the conversation about Medicare. I just hope that this brings more attention to the issues of income inequality and the fact that we as a country have decided to give benefits to wealthy corporations and wealthy individuals while middle class and working class people are paying for the Great Recession.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
The man who sends the investor class diving for their tax shelters. Rick Smith.
At every trough you stop to feed. With your arrogance, your ignorance and greed. Now here come the cuts and redundancy. Through the absolute indifference, the avarice, incompetence, your arrogance, your ignorance, your greed.
You know, I came across this story and asked an interesting question. How bad do you want the latest Apple technology? And they pointed out that this kid in China wanted it so bad that he sold one of his kidneys. I mean, is that where we're coming? I mean, is that the world we want to live in? I got to tell you, it scares me to no end. And now what we've got going on, where we're seeing the Republicans now holding the nation hostage under the debt ceiling, talking about massive, massive austerity measures that are going to harm people, going to destroy education. Look, here in this state, we're talking about allowing education to crumble like our infrastructure has crumbled over the last 30 years because we failed to invest in it. But the question is, how do we get out of it? Where do we go? What are the answers? That's why I've asked Professor Richard Wolff to come talk to us a little bit about some of the work that he's doing. He's got a really good piece, The Ongoing Crisis and Liberal Blindness, over at his website, rdwolff.com. We've also got it linked on our site at thericksmithshow.com. Professor Wolff, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
You know, I look at this situation, it looks like we're double dipping. It looks like we're going to have a double dip recession, kind of a repeat of 1936, because again, we've allowed Republicans to hold us hostage.
Yeah, and you know, for me and for many economists, right-wingers, left-wingers, folks in the center, there's something really unreal about what's going on. Let me give you an example. The Republicans and Democrats both agreed to have a budget this year, which is going to be spending on the federal level $3.5 trillion while taking in $2 trillion in taxes. That's a $1,500 billion deficit.
Correct.
A few weeks ago, we all had to pay attention, as if it were serious, to these supposed adults in the Congress debating over whether the cuts should be $60 billion or $30 billion, and finally compromising at $38 billion. Well, you know, a $38 billion cut in a $1,500 billion deficit is no cut at all.
No.
It's just childish, it's phony, and it counts on the people not understanding these basic numbers and so taking seriously this play acting. But here's the other part of it. When the two parties agreed and together voted both for the initial budget, which they did, and then for this grand compromise on a trivial cut, which
historic.
They both did.
Historic.
Yeah, exactly. Here's what they knew. Given the current debt of the United States, by agreeing to a $1,500 billion deficit, which adds to the debt, they all knew that would require a vote by the Congress to raise the debt ceiling. They knew that. Every advisor, including some of my students, who tell the congressmen and the senators what these things mean, explain to them that if you have a budget like this, you're going to have to raise the debt ceiling. Therefore, to pretend now that the debt ceiling is some surprise, unusual event that they're not going to agree to is pure hypocrisy. It shows the Republicans for being pure political stuntmen in this game, because they voted for what they knew would be the necessity for an increase in the debt ceiling, and now they pretend they're not in favor of what they just voted for.
Right. Well, it gets me, and I got to be honest, you know, I look at this, the reality is Republicans are much better at playing the PR game. They're much better at doing the campaigning, the sloganeering, not so good at governing, but much better at the messaging and all of this political shenanigans. Because I don't think most people are really paying attention because they're too busy working and trying to scrape to make ends meet. So they do these kind of things and they get away with it.
Yeah, I also think that the Republicans have long understood that it's a kind of winning combination. You vote for everything that squeezes middle-income, working-class people, tax cuts that don't favor them but favor the rich, a big bailout in this crisis that systematically favors the biggest companies, et cetera, et cetera. And then when people get angry, not only at the suffering that the crisis imposes on them, but at the gross unfairness of what the government is doing, you present yourself as the candidate and the party that's angry at the government and critical. You literally cash in on the anger of the people that your policies help to produce. It's a remarkable ability, I think, of Republicans to cash in on popular upsets that their policies have promoted. And by cashing in on the upset, they pretend as though they're on the side of the people rather than having been in the leadership of bringing about the very changes that make people upset.
Yeah, you know, and I remember reading Naomi Klein's Shock Doctrine, which I think is almost a must-read for people when you think about what politicians have gotten away with over the years, especially Republicans with these plans and how they create these crises. And look, the Wall Street thing, I think, was, again, they knew had to be coming. All of these crises that they create, and then, oh, gee, now we've got to make the tough decisions. Now we've got to sacrifice, roll up our sleeves. Sorry, Medicare is going to have to go. Medicaid's going to have to go. Sorry, Granny, Social Security, a little too generous. You unemployed folks, way too generous, and you're not out there looking for jobs anyway. You know, it's remarkable, as you've pointed out.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, it doesn't take anyone very long, if you give them half a chance and you explain the economics of this situation. When the crisis came, which working people, Lord knows, had nothing to do with. The government comes in, and it's going to spend a lot of money to try to get the economy out of the mess.
Right.
Let's accept that as, in an emergency situation, what you have to do. Then there are two ways for paying for that. You can either tax those who have it, or you can borrow the money from those who have it to lend. It clearly favors the working class and middle class people to tax corporations and the rich in order to bail out, after all, the same groups, corporations and the rich. But the government chooses not to do that. Unfortunately, Democrats and Republicans alike choose not to do that. And to borrow a truckload of money, billions, trillions of dollars, as the way to give the money to the government that it's going to use to bail it out. Nobody said boo in 2008 and 2009 when the economy was crumbling that the government should spend all that money. Both parties supported it, and both parties supported borrowing it, which I think in retrospect was a mistake, but they did it. Okay, now it's time to kind of pay back these debts. And the argument is, oh, no, we can't tax people to pay back those debts. We have to cut services to the mass of Americans. It's stunning. They're literally going to do, they're going to debate, the Republicans and Democrats, how big cuts to make in what programs in order to save money by not giving it to old people and sick people and just as you listed it. And then they're going to use the money instead to pay back the national debt. Well, let's be honest. Who owns the national debt? Who is it that the government is going to take that money and give it to?
Rich people.
That's right. It's wealthy people.
But they've spun it.
Large corporations and a number of foreign governments,
right,
led by the People's Republic of China.
And that's, you know,
and that's where your grandmother is going to have a harder time getting by, going to have to turn to you, which you don't want and she doesn't want either, because the government is going to be giving that money to the very rich people and the corporations and the foreign governments who lend to the United States. My question to you, and it's the question going around the world, is how long will the mass of people, not just in America, but in Greece or Spain or Italy or all the other countries that are experiencing this, how long are they going to permit this outrage to unfold?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, I've been asking the same question. Well, you know, in Wisconsin, you're seeing some people going to the Capitol, setting up the Walkervilles, and I've been saying, why haven't we seen a reincarnation of Coxey's Army, where, you know, a whole bunch of unemployed workers walk from Massillon, Ohio, to Washington D.C. to say, hey, create job, do something. Why haven't we seen these 20 million unemployed, underemployed people taking to the streets and demanding something to be done?
Yeah,
that's the question.
The sad thing is, I think if they did that, the whole political game in this country would change. I was really struck yesterday on the Sunday news programs. At that time he was the chief financial advisor to President Obama. I hear that he resigned today, but Mr. Goolsbee, the professor of economics from, right, the University of Chicago, answered good questions from reporters who said, why aren't you doing more about jobs, given that unemployment has risen again, et cetera. And he gave this mealy-mouthed answer, you know, and I'm a fellow professor just like him, but he gave this answer, the president is flying to Ohio or something, where he is once again going to be promoting the leveraging approach, giving incentives to private enterprise to do the job of hiring. You know, a student who said that in a class of mine would get a really bad grade. That's been the government policy now since this crisis began, and it's precisely why the unemployment remains horrifically high. The private sector has let us know in no uncertain terms over and over again that no matter how much government money we throw at these companies, they are not going to use it to create jobs. Or to put it more honestly, if they do use some of it to create jobs, it will not be in the United States. It'll be someplace else.
Yeah, I was gonna add that in there because they are creating jobs.
Yes, but not here.
Yeah, and, just in China.
If you want to let them do that because that's profitable for them, okay. But then have the courage to do what Roosevelt did in the 30s and say, as Roosevelt did one day on the radio when he'd had it, if the private sector in the United States either cannot or will not create jobs for the millions of American men and women who want to work, who have skills to bring to bear, and we as a nation need the output they could produce, then there's no alternative but for the government to do it. And from 1934 to 1940, Roosevelt created and filled 11 million federal jobs. Why the American people are not demanding of Mr. Obama and of the Congress and of both parties a similar program after now 4 years of failure to solve the unemployment problem with any other policy is, in my judgment, a kind of testimony to the, I don't even know how to put it, to the hesitance of the American working people to kind of take their destiny in their hands and begin to insist that they have a voice and a role in changing a policy that is not working, above all, for them.
Yeah, I often say that the American worker has a form of Stockholm syndrome, where we identify with our captor. Because, you know, the people who've been torturing us and beating us and taking from us and stealing from us, we seem to identify with, because most of my friends say, you know, Rick, we need to be more business friendly. You gotta do something to attract business into the area. Gotta be more business friendly. And I say friendly like Colombia, where they take union members up in planes and throw them out or pull them off of buses and shoot them in the head. You mean that kind of friendly?
Yeah. And it, you know, also we've had 30 years, if you pardon me, of government competing, one state against another,
yep.
One city against another. Everyone is struggling to be business friendly, to bring jobs to our community, to keep jobs here. And this is a period of time in which the job situation, both in the short run since the crisis hit and in the longer run of the last 30 years, has gotten progressively worse. I mean, after how many years of a policy failing do you keep saying, I'm going to stick with this policy, as if you hadn't noticed what's going on? It is extraordinary. And maybe you're right. Maybe it's a kind of desperate hope that some miracle, something will happen that will change this without us having to do the hard work and sometimes the scary work of building little Walkervilles and all those other things. I'm very moved by the people in Wisconsin because I see them as saying we are not going to be quietly walking away to the decimation of the kinds of lives we've worked hard for, that we've expected, that we thought was the American dream. And I, as a professional economist, I can tell you they're absolutely right. What's going on here is a transition of the American economy from something that wanted and built a large working class with a decent standard of living. I know Americans like to call themselves middle, makes them feel better. That's
yep.
Okay. But it's working people, but who get a decent enough income that they can provide for their kids and have an education and live a proper life. That is being removed. You know, it began 30 years ago when the manufacturing jobs were moved to China and elsewhere to take advantage of low wages. 10 or 15 years ago, a new thing was added to that, the movement of white-collar jobs, jobs that take a college education, et cetera, et cetera. Those got moved to India and other places.
Malaysia.
And now, what the last 10 years show us is the last step. It's because in America, with a working class whose real wages haven't risen for 30 years and who have now borrowed so much money that they can't spend their wages, which aren't rising, they can't borrow anymore. So the future market growth, and I talk to corporations about this all the time, the future market growth that they see is not inside the United States. They're looking at a United States that doesn't suggest they're going to be able to sell more stuff here, but they can sell more in China, in Russia, in Brazil, in India, and that's where they're going. So they're now spending their advertising budget there. They're deciding to give money to universities over there because that's the growth area. They want to impress those people. They want to win those markets.
Yep.
And we're looking at a United States that's going to be looking more and more like those countries we used to feel bad for, where you have 10% of the people living in a kind of comfort zone, surrounded by a vast hinterland of people who are struggling to make ends meet and are not doing a very successful job of it.
No, but here's the thing. We're exceptional. Don't you remember? We're exceptional. We'll be fine. Don't worry about
it. I noticed that the Republicans, once again, are celebrating American exceptionalism. It's that genius of theirs. Just as something is disappearing and people are getting frightened as they notice it's disappearing, they come along and give you, you know, booster talk about how it's all going to be okay if you only vote for them, as if they haven't been in on all the policies that brought us to this situation.
Yeah, it's all about bread and circus, though, or as I've been saying, American Idol and Cheetos.
Yeah,
because
it's stunning, our politics of fakery and phony debates and playing games, as if no one is smart enough to understand that it's always the real suffering at the base that's going to make the change. It makes me, frankly, as an American, you know, I was born in Youngstown, Ohio, which is like a poster child of the very disaster we're talking about.
Yeah, the steel mills.
Yeah, you know, my father was a worker in the Youngstown Sheet and Tube Company when I was born. And, you know, look at it. You know, my relatives and family, they've all lived through this, and they still have a hard time in taking seriously that it's not going to change unless and until they really do something and enter into the political system with the honesty of their needs and suffering instead of this theater of politics that is as phony as a $4 bill.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. So the last question I've got for you, you know, how do we, and this is it's a big question, but now, you know, how do we move forward in this? What do people need to know as we move down this path with the Republicans holding us hostage with this debt ceiling? What is it that we should be looking for?
Well, I think we need a political movement, a resurgence of the labor. Something has to happen. And as far as I can tell, this is what it has as it has to give out as its message. That the attempt is being made in this country to shift the burden of this mammoth crisis, now entering its fifth year, onto the mass of people. That the program of cutting Social Security, reducing Medicaid, laying off public workers, cutting back public services, reducing your pensions if they're private. All of these are ways to make the mass of people pay the cost. They've already suffered the consequences of the crisis. Now they're being asked to pay the cost for the bailout that left them in the lurch in the first place. I think if you were able to get across that that's the issue and that you represented a political party or a movement that was not going to let that shifting of the burden happen, you could gather the kind of support that would make the people at the top have to reconsider what they're doing.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. Professor Wolf, always great to talk with you, always great insight. I'd love to have you back again real soon.
Well, I'd be glad to do it, Rick, and thanks for having a program like this that airs these issues.
All right, thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. Your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. What are your thoughts? We're back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
In an astonishing observation, Representative Paul Ryan recently declared, "Washington has not been honest with you." Gosh, Paul, that possibility never occurred to us. What makes Ryan's observation astonishing is the fact that he is Washington, a 7-term Republican insider, House Budget Chairman, and author of the GOP's ideologically contrived budget-whacking plan that kills America's enormously popular Medicare program. But Ryan didn't mean to point his finger at himself. No, no, he meant those dastardly Democrats who dared to tell the public about his proposal to replace Medicare with a privatized voucher scheme. Understandably, the public is angry at Ryan and his Republican cohorts. Hence, he is scurrying around in a shamefully dishonest PR campaign to accuse the Democrats of, what else, dishonesty. The Ryan plan, he asserts, would give seniors, quote, the same kind of health insurance system members of Congress enjoy today. Oh, Paul, pants on fire. We taxpayers cover 75% of the payments for the plan that you enjoy. But you would saddle older folks with vouchers that would cover only a third of their insurance costs, and that share would shrink with each passing year. Apparently, feeling that telling the truth is unfair in today's politics, Republicans are angry at Democrats for talking about Ryan's Medicare gut job. Senator John Cornyn, the Texas Republican whose sweeping white pompadour covers a totally empty head, recently ranted in feigned outrage that Democrats are trying to scare the daylights out of seniors. I think that's irresponsible, he bellowed, oblivious to his own absurd scare tactics of only 2 years ago when he assailed Obamacare, direly warning that Obama was turning Medicare into, quote, a health care gulag. This is Jim Hightower saying, Republicans can run all they want, but on this one, they can't hide. Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.com.
Radio of, for, and by, we the working people. The Rick Smith Show.
You know, every time I talk to that guy, I mean, I think he's a brilliant guy. And the sad reality is you know, the mainstream economic thought that's been bought and paid for by people like the Koch brothers is direct polar opposite of what someone like Professor Wolf would say. You know, they keep pushing the same failed policies down our throat, and somehow we seem to keep buying it. Let's go to the phone lines. I got Ike on line one. How you doing tonight, Ike?
Hey, buddy. Well, I know you got something coming up at 10:30. I'll just get to it. You know, don't sit here and blame the American workers, because the fact is we've been losing in court. We've been losing in the houses of legislature to the point that they've stripped our rights. They've given more rights to corporations and to businessmen than the average individual walking around on the street has.
Here's where I'm going to stop you on that. The reality is back when unions were illegal, you still had 5% of the workforce in this country unionized. Back when it was illegal, you still had people doing union activity. You know, when times are tough, you know, I'm a firm believer that the way this whole thing's going to turn around is if we do have a collapse and people's bellies are empty. But, you know, I'm not going to go down that road there with you.
No, I'm talking about all the legal protections they have to file bankruptcy and leave people hanging for their pay. And, you know, all through the years, the corporation law has gotten out of hand, and it needs to be reversed. We need card check. We need people to fight for us, which includes these rich Hollywood types and the NFL football types and all the big union money people that are walking around with the cash flowing out of their ears, that have nothing better to do with their time than to worry about what's going on Twitter and somebody else's pants. You know, if they're union members and they're carrying a union card and they've got the money and the power, then they should be putting their money into the pot.
Yep.
You know, the average working guy out here is under so much stress and strain. Who do we fight? Where do we fight? You know, in my world, and, you know, me and you don't see eye in eye to this, but, you know, it continues to hurt me every time I turn around. And I listen to economists, and they go, oh, look at the outsourcing. Look at the trade. Yeah, okay, fine. Look at all those. But the point that me and you will never see eye to eye on is this government allowed perfectly good American citizens to be displaced by third world illegal workers. And they continue to do it.
No,
and
it's not that, hold on.
Turn a blind eye to
it. Yeah, it's not that we disagree on that happened. It's we disagree on how we fix this.
It's called E-Verify. E-verify, period. If you're not legal and you don't belong here, you go home. You e-verify for every job. You e-verify to rent a house. You e-verify to buy a car. E-verify. If you've got identification and you can prove you're a citizen, then welcome to my country. If you're not, then you've got to go. And by the way, your children, just like people that get busted for dealing meth or drugs or doing some other crime, yeah, your kids will probably suffer, but it's your choice. You go home, you can take your kids with you. Don't, this anchor bandy garbage is garbage. Any more different? It's no different from Cubans being allowed to go ahead and come on shore, but the Haitians, oh no, we're going to stop them every which way from Sunday. You know, there's a bunch of stupid stuff that goes on, but the thing is look, the law and the legal system has been put together so these people have been able to prosper even while they've broken the law and done all sorts of indecent, inhumane things to this country. And that's where the problem's at. Eric Holder, the Justice Department, the Labor Department, all this stuff that was set up, they're not getting their job done, they're not doing their job, and furthermore, a vast amount of Americans don't care about people like me that are out here busting our ass every day. And if we could get the jobs back, we would have them back. But you know what? Us construction workers don't matter. Just shut up and build our houses so the bankers, the real estate agents, and everybody else can make money from it. You people just, we want you, you know, as far as we're concerned, you can live like these little Mexican people that we brought over here, 15 to a house.
Well,
and
that's
if
the
so,
goal.
That's your tough luck.
Well, that is the goal. And where we do agree is you know, the draw that brought those folks here are the corporations, and we have not cracked down on them. And there is a movement here in Pennsylvania. They're going to pass the E-Verify. In other states, they've done it as well. And the folks who aren't supposed to be here will deal with.
Well,
but again, for me, it's about opening that up, though. Once you start pushing this.
We need to crack down on Mexico, brother.
Well, yeah. I have a friend who thinks we should put some gunboats in the Gulf of Mexico there, and a little gunboat diplomacy.
Hey, I'm all for alligators in the Rio Grande. I ain't got a problem with it.
Ike, it's always great talking to you, brother.
All right, brother. Later on.
Thanks so much. We're going to take a quick break. We're right back after this with Scott Klingler. He's the tax policy director for Business for Shared Prosperity. We're right back after this.
Saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Do you need a sign or promotional material for your business, campaign, or function? Then All Union Signs and Promos is the place for you. For years, All Union Signs and Promos has been serving South Central Pennsylvania with affordable, high-quality, union-made and American-made signs and promotional products. We want you to be seen. We set ourselves apart not only by being your one-stop, full-service sign shop, but also being able to tie that image into a full line of promotional products. Our dedicated staff will print, design, and deliver your most effective advertising tool on time and on budget. If you have a message, we have a sign. When you need your name on it, All Union Signs and Promos will do it with a memorable and unique union-made and American-made product. For more information about union-made and American-made products, visit our website at allunionsigns.com. That's allunionsigns.com. Or give us a call at 717-221-8888.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
Organizing America 3 hours each night. The Rick Smith Show.
I tip my hat to the new Constitution. Take a bow for the new revolution. Smiling green, change all around. Make a mighty trawler and play. Just like yesterday. Then I get on my knees.
Back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. Again, tomorrow is going to be the 10th anniversary of the first Bush handout. And again, I go back to the clip.
Package of at least $550 billion in across the board tax relief. We will help create more than 1 million new jobs.
$550 billion they're going to hand out in tax relief. Going to create 1 million new jobs. You know, maybe I'm kind of dense, but that's $550 grand a job. How do I get one of those? Now, it never happened. They couldn't even create the 1 million jobs with, you know, each one of them costing $550,000. Couldn't do that. How do I get one? Interesting question. But anyway, to see how the last 10 years have gone for small business leaders, I've asked the folks at Business for Shared Prosperity to come talk to us a little bit. I've got their tax policy director, Scott Klingler, on the line. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Rick. How are you?
I'm good. You know, tomorrow going to be the 10th anniversary. What's the legacy going to be?
Well, I think we all should wear black in mourning because we've spent $1 trillion on these tax cuts, and we have a legacy of huge deficits, rising unemployment, growing inequality, and we haven't created jobs. In fact, your little clip you played about President Bush promising 1 million jobs, well, he did create 1 million jobs, 1.1 million over his entire 8 years of his presidency, most of that after he cut taxes. And just to put that in contrast, President Clinton, in his 8 years, created 22.7 million jobs, 20 times more. And President Clinton did raise taxes early on in his administration. So the mantra that cutting taxes creates jobs doesn't bear out in the facts.
But if you listen to the Republicans today who now have this great tax, this job creation bill, I just saw it. It's a great thing. And it's revolutionary. Let me lay it out for you. Deregulation and tax cuts. Isn't that revolutionary?
Well, I was at one of the House Ways and Means Committee hearings on this very subject last week on corporate tax reform and job creation, and you know they're just shameless. They want few corporations pay what they're supposed to pay, the 35%, and far too many pay zero, and they want a tax cut. How much lower than zero can you pay?
Yeah, here in Pennsylvania, they say 3/4 of the corporations pay zero taxes.
Yeah.
Yet we have the highest tax rate in the country. And I go, but nobody's paying it.
Yep.
How can you have the highest rate if nobody's paying it? But here's the thing that gets me. The GEs of the world, they get away with the Bank of America's. They get away with it. In fact, we subsidize them to stick around. It's the small businesses, people that are members of your group, Business for Shared Prosperity. You're the folks who end up paying the tax.
Well, absolutely. Over the last, probably last generation, but even more so over the last 10 years, we've seen a dramatic shift in taxes off of the wealthy and onto the middle class and off of big business and onto small business. Small business people, your listeners may not realize, but they pay taxes at their individual tax rate. So the money, the income from their business flows through to their individual tax return. So they're paying taxes often in the high 20s, low 30s kind of percents. And one of the myths out there that the Republicans also often use is that these tax cuts for the wealthy help small business people. Well, only 3% of people that report business income have incomes over $250,000. So the vast majority of business people are middle class people, if they're lucky. And a lot of small business people struggle with incomes that probably lower middle class or so.
Tell me about it. That's what we do here at the Rick Smith Show. We're a small business.
Yep.
The same thing. Just what you've laid out. Let me ask you this: that your members of the folks at Business for Shared Prosperity, those small business people, would they prefer to have a tax cut or would they prefer to have customers?
Oh, definitely prefer to have customers. Tax cuts don't create jobs. They're all very clear about that. They're not going to invest if there's no demand for their products. So they want investment in their communities. They want access to capital. One of the sad things is that we're not only talking about these tax cuts for businesses and for wealthy individuals, but we're paying for it by direct cuts to communities and direct cuts to things that affect small business. So the Department of Labor next year is facing a budget cut of about 10%. The Small Business Administration, which supplies loans and business assistance to small businesses, is facing about a 40% cut. And the community development community development block grants which communities use for economic development is being about halved. It's proposed to be cut in half. So these are not good things for small businesses who are already, you know, struggling with the recession and struggling with the customers who have lost their jobs or are behind on their mortgages. So things are looking bleak at the moment.
Amazing. You listen to the Rick Smith Show. We're with Scott Klinger. He's the tax policy director over at Business for Shared Prosperity, businessforsharedprosperity.org. We've got a link over at therickSmithShow.com. Just click on Scott Klingler's name. If I'm hearing you right, and correct me if I'm wrong, but as we start seeing the federal government and all the state governments pulling back, pushing these austerity measures, because, of course, we can't raise revenue. We got to cut. How's that? That's going to harm small business, if I'm hearing you right.
It already is, and it's going to harm small business even more. So, you know, state governments and city governments are laying off teachers and policemen and road construction people. Those are good, solid jobs that are gone. And so those people aren't buying things in stores or using the services of dry cleaners or auto repair places or all the other things that small business people do in communities. We need to change this, and we need to change it fast.
Yeah. So in looking at the Bush handouts, you look at the and the last number I saw was somewhere around $1.3 trillion in handouts we gave to the upper crust. Who benefited most from that? Did you see a trickle down effect? Because we keep hearing this, well, you know, trickle down economics. You know, we give everything to the people at the top, and whatever they can't stuff in their pockets will flow out onto the ground, and then the rest of us can scramble for that.
Well, the one thing is that the Republicans were very clever about was they made sure everybody got something, and as you might expect, the people at the bottom got crumbs, and the people at the top got filet mignon. So I did a little look at this right before you called, and in this current year, the Bush tax cuts for the lowest 20% of income earners, that's people with incomes, families with incomes about $20,000 or less, they got about a little less than $2 a day, $396 for the year. People in the top 1% got almost $77,000, that's $200 a day. So the poorest people got $2 a day, the richest people got $200 a day, and those right in the middle got about $4 a day. So you can see where the money went.
You can see where the priorities were as well.
Right.
And again, you know, I go back to this because I think it's important. The reality is that money that we handed out did not do what they told us it was going to do. It did not create jobs. At least not in this country. I guess you could make the argument that the Bush tax cuts did create jobs in places like India and China and Brazil, but not here.
Yep.
And that, not good for small business.
Right.
So last thing I've got for you, as we're looking at this, and I'm saying this decade, this lost decade, how do we get ourselves out of this? What's the answer here?
Well, one of the things we'd like to ask all your listeners to do is to call your U.S. Senator and U.S. Congressperson tomorrow. There's a national call-in day to ask that we rescind the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest 1% and that we restore the rates that were in effect 10 years ago before the Bush tax cuts were around, and also to block any further corporate tax cuts. There's a lot of efforts right now by corporations to cut their taxes even more, to allow them to bring back all the money they've had in offshore tax havens and pay a very low rate on it. So, Congress is not serious about reducing the deficit when they're still talking about giant handouts to the wealthiest, most powerful people and institutions in the country.
Yeah, I mean, you just hit on what I think is a huge one, that whole repatriation thing that they're quietly kind of pushing out there. You know, if we could bring that money back, if we could bring it back from the Cayman Islands where we have those offshore accounts, if we could bring it back from all the places all over the world, we might even create a job or two for you.
Well, they said that last time, and they ended up not creating those jobs either. So that there's going to be a new bill, exciting new bill introduced in a couple of weeks on tax havens, and maybe we can come back and talk about that.
That would be great. I'd appreciate it. Scott, I appreciate your time. I appreciate the work you guys do there. Fantastic stuff.
And we appreciate you. Thanks so much, Rick.
Thanks so much. And again, you know, you go back to this, and as he pointed out, the reality is you know, this is the same line they gave us before. And I go back to Bush. I always come back to Bush. I love my Bush clips. I always go back to the Bush.
There's an old saying in Tennessee. I know it's in Texas, probably in Tennessee, that says, fool me once, shame on you. If fool me, you can't get fooled again.
We're right back after this.
Oh, that's painful.
Radio of, for, and by We the Working People. The Rick Smith Show.
My name is Joanna, and my job is to protect children, to help them live in safe and stable families. I work for you, the taxpayers, in Children and Youth Services. Every day, I help children and families in crisis. Many parents have lost their jobs, making it harder to keep a roof overhead, food on the table, and stress under control. My caseloads are huge, and waiting lists for critical services are too long. Yet I know the safety of these children depends on me. Even in tough economic times, legislators must fund these vital programs. Because if we don't help these kids now, the cost to them and to us will be much higher later on. Children don't only depend on me doing my job. They're counting on you to care about their safety. Contact your state legislators today. Demand that they invest in programs that prevent and treat child abuse. Because a child in pain shouldn't have to wait.
Brought to you by SEIU Local 668. Visit our website at SEIU668.org and join our Human Services campaign.
Hi, I'm Bob Snyder, president of Teamsters Local 776 here in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. For more than 100 years, Teamsters have been standing together to create a better tomorrow. We Teamster members are your friends and neighbors. Teamsters move goods across the nation, take care of seniors, serve and protect our community, and so much more. We are hardworking, dedicated professional workers, united to make our lives, our communities, and our nation stronger. If you want to be part of the team, join the Teamsters for a better tomorrow. Contact us at 1-800-692-6280. That's 1-800-692-6280. Or visit our website at TeamstersLocal776.org. We are people helping people.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Rick, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can go to thericksmithshow.com, download our podcast there for your entertainment, your enjoyment, and, of course, your convenience. You know, the right's been screaming about this. Well, you know, if we do these things, we could have a lost decade. Well, you know what? I think I'd argue we just had one. I think the last 10 years, we have seen a lost decade. And if you look at the wage gains for American workers, they have been completely stagnant. So I would argue for you and me, it has been a lost decade. You know, you look at over the past decade, real private sector wages, they have scraped the bottom at just about 4%. Now, understand, a 4% increase over the last 10 years, not that great. That's worse than the 10 years from 1929 to 1939. It's worse than the Depression when you're looking at real wages. And it's really the worst 10-year period since World War II. And you can thank that on these we need to be business-friendly policies that just not happening. Just not happening. And what frustrates me is you've got people who are out there defending this. We need to be more business friendly, Jake. That's what they say. More business friendly. You got to help the business. Give them more tax cuts. Yes.
Well, unfortunately, Rick, if you take a public opinion poll and you ask people, are your taxes too high? far, far, far too many of them will say, oh, yes.
They are. My taxes are too high.
For me, for the individual, but when the Republicans say that, they're referring to corporate taxes, and you and I both know they're almost at historical lows.
Well, all taxation is at historical lows. As a number of the economy, you know, we're at a 60-year low. And you know who's not paying? People at the top. You know, I agreed with the T-Twizzlers. Taxed enough already. I am. I'm feed enough. I'm taxed enough. Every time I turn around, somebody wants me to reach in my pocket. Mm-hmm.
And by the way, that extends to small businesses, too. Some of the small businesses, their taxes are too high. Again, they're paying also.
Now, you look at the fact that wages for people like you and me went up just 4%. What happened to our friends at the CEO class? What happened to the bosses? Of course, you know, their wages couldn't have gone up much more than that, right? You know, because shared sacrifice. Remember, all in this together. All in this. Hands in, rope sleeves, get hands dirty. In 2010 alone, they saw their pay increase by 27%. Their bonuses up by 20%. They're doing just fine. People like you and I, we're the ones who are struggling. And you look at the reality, every time you turn around, we're getting screwed at the gas pump. Why? Speculators. And I think Bernie Sanders last week nailed it. He said, look, at the end of the day, man, these gas prices, as high as they are, it's Wall Street. It's the oil speculators. He said, and this is what, right out, quote, 10 years ago, oil speculators controlled about 30% of the oil futures market. Today, he said, oil speculators on Wall Street control over 80% of the market. In fact, their sole function in life is to speculate, to drive up oil prices, and to make money. So every time you go to the gas tank, every time you put that nozzle in, what are you doing? You're enriching the Wall Street speculators, the hedge fund managers, the people who are...
Several weeks ago, Rick, they had congressional meetings, exactly what you're talking about the high price of oil, and they had one of the top CEOs there from one of the major oil companies, and according to him, and of course he's, to be fair, he's trying to deflect some of this blame from the oil companies themselves, but according to him, if it wasn't for the manipulators and oil speculators, instead of costing about $100 a barrel, it would cost about $60 if it wasn't for the speculators. But again, I mean, you can't just blame it all on them, although a good part of it, but the oil companies themselves are part of the reasons for the high cost.
You know, here's the reality, though, and this is where Sanders is spot on. We haven't done enough to rein that in. We really haven't.
Yep.
And what we've got now is you're pushing these budgets, not just on the federal level, but also on the state level. Some of these really radical right-wing budgets that are going to harm communities, are going to harm education. And what's going on is nobody seems to be standing up for you and me. And I think Sanders' message to Obama was pretty simple. Stop selling us out. Stop capitulating. Stop. Stand up for the American people. Stop giving in to the terrorists.
I agree with you, Rick. The president has been a little bit shown a lack of courage at times, a lack of backbone. I think from a political standpoint, I mean, he's been getting punched in the mouth so many times. He's coming around as far as his political knowledge, but sometimes there's still those old habits from the Senate. And he's got to understand he's now the big kahuna. He's the big kahuna. You can't compromise on every issue. You got to learn to draw a line in the sand and say, this is my position. I will not change. And he's been very, very reticent and hesitant to do that.
Yeah. But here's the reality. When you have 400 individuals in this country, the Forbes 400, when they own more wealth than the bottom half of your country, when 400 people control more wealth than half of your country, you have a problem. When 400 people, who you can fit into a pretty good-sized room, control more wealth than 150 million people, you have a problem. You do. And what to me it is, it's a taxation problem. Pretty simple. You look at this debt ceiling fight. To me, it's about you're not bringing in enough revenue. You know, and I've said this a number of times. You know, in the Smith household, if we've got to do that whole exercise of, you know, it's all about kitchen table economics. Well, in the Smith household, when the light bill and the mortgage and the phone bill and all that stuff add up, your basic necessities add up, and you don't have enough money, you go out and you make more. You bring more revenue into the house. You can't cut those things. That's your core expense. You got to pay that. So you go out and you get some more money. We're not doing that as a government. We seem to think we can cut our way out of this. It's not going to happen. And I like what Carl Bernstein said on MSNBC. He basically came out and said, look, this whole fight over the debt limit, this whole debt ceiling thing, it's all manufactured. It's all fake. It's all BS. He said, look, at the end of the day, what has to happen is we got to start looking at trimming back some of the entitlements, yes, but also you got to raise revenue. That's the end game. And to me, when you start looking at the entitlement programs, I've always said we should be means testing. Social Security is not a retirement plan, never was meant to be. It is an anti-poverty program. So granny, grandpa, granny, when they get to the old age, they can't work anymore. Their bodies are broken down and beaten, and they can't labor anymore. They get a little bit of money, help them make it through to the end. Friends that I know who are very, very wealthy, they don't need it. They don't need those couple of bucks. That's when you start means testing. You don't take it all away, but you just say, look, you don't need this. Or you raise their tax a little bit more. I know, Rick. Oh, you're redistributing wealth. You bet you're behind. Just like we've been doing for the last 30 years. Redistributing from the people who create it, the people who go and get their hands dirty and break their backs and abuse their bodies. Creating that wealth so that the unafflicted can sit in luxury and collect their dividend checks by poolside. I think that we should be talking about unredistributing.
Well, when you think about when you listen to that phrase, if you want to get technical, every time you talk about every time the Congress deals with tax policies, they're redistributing wealth one way or the other. Now, we want a redistributed dower. We want a little bit fairer system, but somehow that's a left-wing communist socialist conspiracy. However, when they want to redistribute wealth upward,
it's capitalism.
That's good. It's capitalism. It's good for the economy. Isn't it amazing?
Nice. But here's the thing. You know, you look at Social Security, it was anti-poverty insurance. And I'm a firm believer in means testing. Also, I think we need to redefine what poverty is. I mean, you know, what is poverty? You know, granny eating cat food, is that poverty? Having to decide between food and medicine? Is that poverty? I mean, these are questions and these are ideas that we're really gonna have to struggle with. Because I'm not going the Alan Simpson route where we're gonna raise the retirement age to such a high number that it works like it used to. And again, he was very clear. You know, back when people died at 57, they made the retirement age 65. See, we're fixing things, making sure it works like it used to. See, so you die at 56, and then you get to collect your Social Security at 65. See, so the system works. So we're reforming the current system so it works like it used to. So you're dead, you know, several years before you can collect.
Simpson, you can tell where he worked. He didn't work in the real world.
Which is why he can still walk at 80-some years old.
Congressman Simpson, look, the human species has evolved, but in the last 50 to 100 years, it hasn't evolved to the point where people can, especially in a very physical job, they just can't work anymore after a certain point. A lot of people, late 50s, early 60s, their body is saying, you can't work anymore. That's just called reality.
Yep. A little bit of history today. Those of you who want to read the Bush playbook, George Orwell's 1984 was published on this day in 1949. It's amazing how that book has has really become the GOP playbook. We're going to take a quick break right back after this. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425.
Smith Show, changing America for the better. The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg. The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News Service. I'm Jesse Russell. Organizers of a labor rally in Erie, Pennsylvania on Saturday intended to show solidarity between unions currently in negotiations with General Electric. They expected more than 1,000 workers to show up, but when more than 3,000 filled the Hammer Mill Center at Gannon University, the organizers said they were surprised. 10 unions have been in negotiations with GE since May 23rd. The current contract offered by GE would end the defined pension plan for new hires and implement a health care plan that doubles the cost for workers. Outside of the contract, another issue that was highlighted at Saturday's rally was GE's profit making while not paying taxes. According to a recent report in New York Times, GE saw $14.2 billion in worldwide profits in 2010, with $5.1 billion thanks to U.S. operations. GE reported that it only paid 7.4% in taxes on those U.S. profits. What GE pays in taxes is barely a third of the average of other major corporations. Further upsetting workers is that GE has reduced U.S. employment by 22,000 jobs since 2007, even while President Barack Obama has tapped GE chief executive Jeffrey Immelt as U.S. job czar. Meanwhile, a couple states away in Wisconsin, Walkerville returned to the Capitol. Walkerville is a tent city of sorts that originally popped up during the first 30 days of protests at the Wisconsin Capitol. This week, Walkerville returned, surrounding the Capitol, to protest the governor's deep budget cuts. Doug Cunningham spoke with some of the first residents of this new Walkerville.
Betsy Kippers, vice president of the Wisconsin Education Association Council, was one of the first people setting up tents in Walkerville.
Since we are no longer able to voice our protests inside the Capitol building, we decided to set up a tent city outside the building to make sure people are hearing our voices against Governor Walker's budget, which is being dealt with this week. So we are going to be out here until the budget is done, and we are going to have our voices heard about the damage that Governor Walker is doing to the citizens of this state with his budget.
Beth McClure was erecting a tent with her husband and two small children.
Close to $800 million of education cuts are a real concern for us. Medicaid cuts, the national level, the conversation about Medicare. I just hope that this brings more attention to the issues of income inequality and the fact that we as a country have decided to give benefits to wealthy corporations and wealthy individuals while middle class and working class people are paying for the Great Recession.
You've been listening to WIN, the Workers' Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
You know, ever since we got back from Wisconsin, back in February, we have been saying you need to get out in the streets. I want to see little Hoovervilles, or in this case in Wisconsin, Walkervilles or Corbettvilles or Kasichvilles, wherever you're at. I want to see that spring up. I also want to see the whole Cochise Army thing. People, you know, in the streets, the unemployed taking to the streets saying, hey, do something. Don't steal from us. Don't destroy programs to benefit the ultra wealthy. Help the people who are struggling. That's why I think it's so important to focus on places that are doing things like Wisconsin. Right now, there are people in Madison who are setting up little Walkervilles. They're camping out at the Capitol, and I got to tell you, I'm hoping that happens here in Harrisburg. I'm hoping those college kids bring their sleeping bags and camp out here, just like they did there in Madison. I've got Malin Mitchell on the line. He's president of the Professional Firefighters of Wisconsin. Malin, thanks for taking time for us.
Oh, my pleasure. Nice to be on with the show again.
What's going on there today?
Well, we actually, today is Public Service Day in Walkerville here in Tent City. We had about 400 to 500 firefighters here and about 1,000 people that marched with us total around the Capitol Square, and we're here to just protest the bill, the big budget bill, and also the budget repair bill that we've been protesting for the last 2 or 3 months.
You know, one of the things that was remarkable to me, the firemen and the police and the firefighters and the police, they were left out of the attacks by Walker back in February. Yet you guys stood up and said, you know, an attack to one of us is an attack to all of us. And it was you guys who I really thought were the glue that stuck everything together.
Well, we appreciate that, but the real reason why we were here was because, like you said, an attack on one union is an attack on everybody, and I think. The legislature and this administration has undermined it and actually thought that the union movement wouldn't come out the way it has and drones and come out to speak against this bill. We've done that. That's why firefighter police officers are here. We realize that we're exempt now, but who knows what's going to come up later. But even if we are exempt, it doesn't matter because this is wrong, and what's wrong is what we got to stand up for, and that's why firefighters and police officers have been here. Our job is to respond to emergencies, and that's what we're doing right now.
And this is an emergency. One of the things that we've been following are the recall efforts. I guess all six Republicans that could be recalled, they're going to be up on the ballot?
Well, right now we have definitely three, and the other three are under contention right now. But by the end of the week, we should hear about the other three. But it looks like all six will be up on the ballot. There are three Democrats that we'll know by the end of next week if they're up on the ballot or not. But it looks like there's going to be six definitely recall elections that would happen July 12th. If there's a primary, then it'll happen August 9th. But we're going to have a chance to at least do our voice at the ballot box. And that's where it really matters because elections matter.
Yeah, and this time maybe some sane voters will get out to the polls and not put so many of these radicals into office. Because truthfully, you know, Wisconsin's been a fairly moderate state. To have someone like Walker, who I believe is really a radical, take control of your state, to me, you know, tells kind of the time of 2010.
Yeah, you're exactly right. And the thing is, you know, we had 39.5%, 40% of union members vote for this administration. With Governor Scott Walker, and that's because a lot of people didn't quite know the issue, and I take some of the blame for that as well as the other union leaders around the state, is that we didn't educate our members very well. We were at sleep, so to speak, at the helm and at the steering wheel, but now that is not the case. Many members know that what's going on, and the members that never get involved politically or actively are now involved, and he's galvanized the state of Wisconsin and its union members, not only its union members, but its middle class, to come together and fight against this administration, against this anti-union, anti-middle class agenda, to make sure we can elect people that care about issues that deal with middle class.
You know, I've been saying for the longest time that Wisconsin was ground zero. That's the first battleground, and if you guys can hold the attacks there, maybe the rest of us won't have to fight those same attacks in our states.
Right, and that's what we hope. I mean, a win in Wisconsin, I think it will just prove across the nation that workers right there are attack, and we're going to stand up and fight back as the chant goes. But I think we have to win. I mean, we have to win in Wisconsin one way or the other, and we're going to win. It may take time. You know, the 15th chapter wasn't built overnight. We're going to have sustainability and make sure we get the job done for not just in the state of Wisconsin, but for other members all across the United States.
Yeah, how many people do you have there tonight in Walkerville?
Well, I'm actually sitting right outside Walker. I'm actually in Walkerville right now. Looks like we have tents lining up and down the square right outside the Capitol. We weren't able to get on the Capitol side, so we're on the Madison side, actually. Got a permit to stay here, but as far as I can see, I see tents and I see people, so... a lot of people out here tonight, a lot of energy. It's a little bit hot outside, believe it or not. Last time I talked to you, it was probably below zero. Now it's about 75, 80 degrees. That's how Wisconsin goes, you know.
Yeah, I would expect to see more people out there tonight than when we were in Madison when it was bitter and freezing cold.
Yeah, You know what? But even in the cold, the energy that we had was just simply unbelievable. I mean, you were here, you felt it, and today we did the same thing, and we had firefighters, and we actually got in the Capitol today, and we were able to throw a couple of chants at them and able to let them know that we're still watching and we're still here, and we're not going to give up until the fight is over, and make sure that our voices are heard.
And Malin Mitchell,
be here until the job is done.
Yeah, Malin Mitchell, the work you guys are doing, outstanding. Keep up the faith, and whatever we can do to help, let us know.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks so much. Malin Mitchell, president of the Professional Firefighters of Wisconsin, there in Walkerville. And look, you know, I've been saying for the longest time, we need to be doing this kind of stuff right here at home. This is the kind of stuff I would love to see this week, tomorrow, the day after, as they start really going high test, really putting the pedal to the metal on their radical agenda. Look, 916 isn't dead. That horrible unemployment bill that Scott Perry tried to ram through, it's not dead. They still got another crack at it. And if they ram that through, I don't think they're going to be able to, but you know, who knows? You know, the 11th hour, 3 o'clock in the morning, who knows what happens? But at the end of the day, all of these attacks have to be met. And I really wanted to see some college kids get their sleeping bags and say, you know what? You're not going to take 55% of the higher education budget. You're not going to destroy public education, and we're going to fight you on it.
Well, that still could happen. All the great movements in my lifetime, you're talking about the civil rights movement, the war movement, we're pretty much, especially anti-war movement, the young people were in the vanguard. We were up there, Rick. You and I both know the people that were leading those rallies were the younger people. I mean, it was unbelievable, the energy level. I marveled at those people. They just went for hours and hours and hours.
Well, what they did is they actually read the bill and they looked at their future and they said, you know what? This is going to destroy my future. This is the end for me. You know, and again, I keep putting that out there that, you know, the more we allow these folks to get away with what they're doing, the worse the future is going to look. The worse tomorrow is going to be.
You have to just totally admire those young. They had rallies at 12. They had one at 5. And you and I and Brett, when we slept in the Capitol, you and I both know, you know, that energy level went way into the night. And this went on day after day, week after week. It was something I'll never forget.
Yeah, that's the reason. One of the reasons we went. I mean, to be part of history. And it was. It was just that in a nutshell. But it was also about how does this whole thing work? How do we get this thing moving? Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, your calls, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. Measures we explore, marching on the Capitol to lobby leaders for involvement. 3,000 people screaming out, where's our government? Lawsuits and arraignments, members under company surveillance, public divided, even the normal star they hate it. Brought the billions off our back, and it's still not enough. They should have broken through a gap that we never give up. We'll be here.
Radio experience where hard work, common sense, and rational thought are a reality. The Rick Smith Show.
In an astonishing observation, Representative Paul Ryan recently declared, "Washington has not been honest with you." Gosh, Paul, that possibility never occurred to us. What makes Ryan's observation astonishing is the fact that he is Washington, a 7-term Republican insider, House Budget Chairman, and author of the GOP's ideologically contrived budget-whacking plan that kills America's enormously popular Medicare program. But Ryan didn't mean to point his finger at himself. No, no, he meant those dastardly Democrats who dared to tell the public about his proposal to replace Medicare with a privatized voucher scheme. Understandably, the public is now angry at Ryan and his Republican cohorts. Hence, he is scurrying around in a shamefully dishonest PR campaign to accuse the Democrats of, what else, dishonesty. The Ryan Plan, he asserts, would give seniors, quote, the same kind of health insurance system members of Congress enjoy today. Oh, Paul, pants on fire. We taxpayers cover 75% of the payments for the plan that you enjoy. But you would saddle older folks with vouchers that would cover only a third of their insurance costs, and that share would shrink with each passing year. Apparently, feeling that telling the truth is unfair in today's politics, Republicans are angry at Democrats for talking about Ryan's Medicare gut job. Senator John Cornyn, the Texas Republican whose sweeping white pompadour covers a totally empty head, recently ranted in feigned outrage that Democrats are trying to scare the daylights out of seniors. I think that's irresponsible, he bellowed, oblivious to his own absurd scare tactics of only 2 years ago when he assailed Obamacare, direly warning that Obama was turning Medicare into, quote, a health care gulag. This is Jim Hightower saying, Republicans can run all they want, but on this one, they can't hide.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit HightowerLowdown.org.
Demanding the super rich to pay their fair share for once. The Rick Smith Show.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com, or you can email me, rick at thericksmithshow.com. I do answer all emails personally. Another Borowitz report, and I got to tell you, I love this guy. I think he's funny. But this time it's about Sarah Palin. He writes, quote, visiting Thomas Jefferson's historic home, Monticello, former Alaska governor Sarah Palin today paid tribute to the nation's third president, telling an audience of supporters, we must never forget the wisdom of Jefferson and his wife Wheezy. Can't forget that. Governor Palin said that at a time of our history when the American people needed leadership, it was Jefferson who said the immortal words, we're moving on up. Those of you who don't get it, it's the old Jefferson TV show from back in the 70s. Kind of a joke, haha. The former Alaska governor criticized in recent days over her grasp of American history, used the Monticello speech to demonstrate her knowledge of the country's founding fathers, saying, quote, let us have the ingenuity of Benjamin Franklin, who invented the electric chair. Let us have the honesty of George Washington, who told his father that he chopped down the cherry tree because it was blocking his view of Russia. And let us have Washington's perseverance, which he demonstrated during that harsh winter at Sweet Valley High. But she saved her most fulsome praise for her favorite American hero, Paul Revere, when she said, in his famous cry, if one by land, two if by sea, Paul Revere proved that you don't have to know how to count higher than two to be a great American. At the end of her speech in Monticello, Governor Palin said that she was looking forward to her next stop on her bus tour, which I guess is going to be in Philadelphia, the home of the Taco Bell. So there you go. The Liberty Bell, get it? Yeah, good for you. I mean, what's really funny about this is she can't just say, you know what, someone stuck a camera in my face and I just blathered something. I wasn't thinking. Yeah, I got it wrong. I screwed it up. No, she cannot possibly do that.
She defends it.
She's got to defend it. And, oh, well, you know, blah, blah, blah. So what happens? She gets a bunch of her minions to go and do the Winston Smith thing and try and rewrite history. So they go onto the Wikipedia and they go and they try and change things around so it fits what Cuckoo could do is pushing. Just amazing to me. Just amazing.
Cuckoo Cadu?
Yeah.
Is that her new name?
Okay. Yeah. Can you think of a more fitting one? That's a whole lot of cuckoo right there. Maybe not quite as much as the
KKD.
Okay. Anyway, the Senate has a Bill 995, and I love this. It's pretty funny. It says, an act amending Title 35, Health and Safety, of the Pennsylvania Consolidated Statutes, requiring that the operator of each permitted gas well within Pennsylvania's post certain 911 response information at they got to post certain 911 response information at the entrance of each well. So they're putting out legislation now to make sure that 911 information is posted by the wells. Wouldn't you think that this would have been something we would have thought about long before the first well got pumped into the ground? Wouldn't you think you'd have thought of this after maybe the first, second, third explosion? I don't know. Call me strange. I thought you'd have got ahead of that. Maybe just a little bit. Just a little bit. And I understand. We have got Mr. Bean, the Lieutenant Governor, Jim Cawley, who told an audience in Bucks County that, quote, there has never been a documented case of water being affected by fracking for Marcellus Shale.
Oh.
And I'm going, really? Never? Never? What about that big, you know, what about that big cardboard cutout moment? Remember, you know, the big cardboard cutout moment where they had a big drilling fine of
$1 million.
Yeah, remember that? The big giant fine.
$1 million.
You go, really?
We get the warhead and we hold the world ransom for $1 million.
Don't you think we should maybe ask for more than $1 million? $1 million isn't exactly a lot of money these days.
Maybe just a little. I don't know. Call me strange. But, you know, they did that. You know, $1 million they tried to get out of them. And if you read the details, 200,000 of which went to capping wells, something they were going to have to do anyway. And, again, you know, you know, I'm just scratching my head going, really? Is this what? Is this, are these the people who are running this thing? And the answer is, yeah. I mean, it's scary times. I worry. I gotta tell you, I worry about what's going on. Here's some good news, though. I was reading in the paper today, and I'm going to give the gym a little plug. It's called Snap Fitness. They're at Peyton Place Shopping Center off Lingolstown Road here in the area. Something I've been talking about for years that I never understood why people don't do it. This Snap Fitness place, what they have done is they have exercise bikes that are actually powering the place. So people sit on the bikes and they're pedaling away, and they're actually creating energy. And again, it's one of these things that, you know, like a 9-year-old, like my 9-year-old daughter would go, Dad, why haven't we always been doing that? Because we're stupid, I think. You know, just like she said, you know, why aren't there solar panels on all of the Walmarts? Why aren't there solar panels on all of the malls? Why don't all the schools and the government buildings, why aren't they all solar panels? Why aren't all the gyms outfitted with bikes and treadmills and those things that make you go round and round and round, you know, like a rabbit on a hamster cage? You know, why aren't we creating energy with this? Doesn't it seem just kind of sense, like common sense on some level? But good for them. You know, it's one of those things that I think is important. Mm-hmm. And again, in the coming days, we're going to be talking a lot about solar as I go through the process, and I'm looking forward to it. I'm looking forward to the process of putting solar panels on our house, because it's going to help us, you know, save on our electric bill. It's going to help us, you know, make a couple of bucks off the SREX. And it's going to help green our society, help take some of the pressure off the grid. I'm a big fan of it. And I think here in the state, we need to pass House Bill 1580. And when we talk to some reps over the next couple of days, we're gonna bring that up. But also, we need to have an energy policy in this country that says, you know what? We're going to invest in this stuff, or we're going to make sure that it gets done. We have that ability. We do, honestly. And we were just talking today about rail. You know, we're talking to somebody who lives in the Pittsburgh area saying, you know, when they privatized the portion of the Port Authority there and took away the prime runs, Evidently, they're about going broke. The privatization scheme is failing because they doubled the price, they lowered the service, and people who would have taken that route are now going to the other public terminals to go in. So what you're seeing is you're seeing the public lines packed beyond recognition, beyond capacity, and the private line is struggling. And, you know, you talk to all the folks in the transportation industry. Right now, with gas at $4 a gallon, people are flocking to public transportation because it's cheaper. It's more economical. It's going to get you there. And you know what? It's not going to cost you an arm and a leg.
And then we look at this area where we had a chance a couple years ago. And, again, lack of foresight, lack of integrity, and here we are. That Corridor 1 would have been great for the area. Would have provided so many jobs, would have provided an opportunity for people to keep their cars home and ride rail to work. And we got nothing. Now we got gridlock. You come into Harrisburg in the morning, wow, it's just like any other big city. Gridlock wherever you go.
And it's a small place. I mean, we don't really need to have it this bad. I mean, it's just amazing. Just absolutely amazing to me. Anyway, it is what it is, I guess. When we come back, I want to talk about the big presidential race. The big race is on. Santorum now throwing his hat into the ring. I'm kind of thinking maybe we should have like an American Idol kind of competition. Everybody who's a registered Republican should go into like a big auditorium, like a big stadium, and we should have like a debate off. Because the Republican candidates, there isn't a qualified one among them. Maybe Romney, maybe, even though he's running away from himself, how can you trust a guy who has some pretty good credentials and some pretty good accomplishments, but is turning his back on it? I don't know. Anyway, your call is 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. We're right back. Going to talk about the big 2012 race.
Together. The Rick Smith Show.
Ask me, Council 13 members, did you know that you have voluntary benefits available to you that you can pay for through the ease of payroll deduction? Ask me, Council 13 offers a voluntary benefits package to help provide money when you or a covered family member incurs one of these life events, accidents, critical illness, disability, or death. No one can avoid life's unfortunate situations. However, AFSCME Council 13 has provided you with the opportunity to ease the financial burden on your family by preparing now. Find out more about Trustmark's voluntary benefits. BBS Benefit Solutions can help you get the security you need. Call BBS at 1-866-902-2561. Again, call BBS at 1-866-902-2561.
Chances are, when you took a shower this morning, an AFSCME member made sure that water was clean. When you drove to work, an AFSCME member maintained the road. When you rode an elevator, an AFSCME member inspected it. I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. AFSCME members enforce regulations, keep prisoners behind bars, take care of patients, protect the environment, and more. The work isn't glamorous, the salaries aren't high, but AFSCME members serve the public in every aspect of our daily lives. Chances are, you'll never see that AFSCME member working in a sewage plant, diving underwater to repair a bridge, or answering a 911 call. But aren't you glad they do? For more information, visit AFSCME13.org. We are AFSCME.
We make it, we make it happen.
your smart policy. And sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
Yes, the horse race. The horse race is coming, folks. I mean, but it's really kind of anticlimactic when there's nobody. There's nobody really winning this whole thing, and there's nobody really of any consequence as far as I'm concerned. You know, at the end of this, you know, most of these people suck. And I got to be honest, I would be scared for the country. If one of them won, I think that's kind of where I'm at with this. But you know, the new poll out has Mitt Romney up, has him being the guy who everyone says, well, I could see him. Rasmussen said about 49% of likely voters said he was qualified to be president, while 25% said no, not qualified. Now Sarah Palin, on the other hand, only 23% said she was qualified, with a whopping 63% saying, are you freaking kidding me? Other candidates in the survey were Tim Pawlenty, Ron Paul, and Gingrich, who had pretty poor numbers. Paul had 27% who thought he was qualified, 43% who said no, and you know, Pawlenty, who had, you know, 30% saying no, not so much. Gingrich, 48% not qualified. So the majority of the Republican field right now, the American electorate, or at least the Republicans who they're polling, saying no, these guys, not the people we're going to be voting for. And you look at Romney, and Romney's kind of one of those guys who you go all over the map, coming out and saying I didn't believe in Romney care. You know, we made people responsible. That's how I'm going to get around it. But I don't believe in Obamacare. But I do believe that climate change is man-made and it's real. Not a right-wing talking point. Probably should have lost that. Probably not a very good campaign slogan there, Mitzi, especially for the crazy people. He's also proved that he doesn't really care about deficits because he's endorsing these bizarre spending caps. Now, stop and think about this for a second, Jake, and this is what gets me. You got Romney out there saying that he is going to put a federal cap of 20% or less of GDP. What kind of a businessman is he that he's only going to look at the spending side and not the revenue side? We've heard him say nothing about raising revenue. So even if he's right, and we cap spending at 20% of GDP, and we have falling tax rates, we could still have massive spiraling deficits because they absolutely refuse. Absolutely refuse. Because remember, we're at about 16% of GDP right now. If you're going to cap it at 20, what's that mean?
Isn't some of this, I mean, let's be honest, isn't some of this intended to get votes from his Republican conservative base?
Yes.
That's what it's about.
But understand what the point of it is. When he's throwing this out, it sounds great. We're going to cap it at 20%. Never going to go above that. Ain't going to do it. We're going to be right there. But when you stop and you break it down and you go, hold on. When you stop and you break it down, you look at it from a rational point of view. If you're not raising revenue and you're taking 20% of GDP and that's where your cap is, and you're spending 20% and you're bringing in 14-15% in revenue, you still have a massive gap.
With Romney, he's going to have to embrace some of these almost bizarre concepts to get the conservative vote. However, even if he wins, he's then going to have to explain those positions to the rest of us. And there's where he has his problem.
Pawlenty in the news as well. The Center for Public Integrity notes that in the last election cycle, Morgan Stanley executives gave Pawlenty more than $79,000 to his Freedom PAC, more than any other company's executives except for Federated Insurance, according to the Center for Responsive Politics. Morgan Stanley executive Bill Strong, who is a co-chair of Poletti's presidential campaign, has been spearheading much of the fundraising. Poletti's going after the financial, the big wigs, the people who have, you know, got their pockets full already or doing very well, and the ones who don't like the Dodd-Frank financial reform. Understand, the Republicans are going to have to run on repealing that and destroying it. And they are. Rest assured, they are. Another good news, you know, Rick Santorum made the big announcement today. Big announcement. Going to run for president. Going to do it on family values. Going to do it on good, you know, hypocritical values. You know, his big day. I mean, this is his big debutante ball. This is Sweet 16, baby! You know, this is his day. This is his moment. And Wiener gets more press. And in fact, Tricky Ricky got bumped. Got bumped from Greta Van Susteren. In fact, on his Facebook page, on his big day, his big coming out, this is it. This is his coming out of the closet, man. Swinging that door wide open. He writes, due to scheduling difficulties, Senator Santorum will be on the record with Greta Van Susteren on Tuesday night instead of tonight. So on his big day, this was it. This was the big day. This was it, man. He got bumped, which tells you kind of what they think of his chances.
He's got some problems over and above his positions. I don't
problems?
Think he, well, no. I'm
just
talking,
look at him. He's got
no,
problems.
I'm talking politics, you know, politics ABCs here. He doesn't have the fundraising ability, and his own personal wealth is not that great. And he's going up against some people that got some money.
Which is why I'm a proud supporter of Palin Santorum 2012.
Well, here's where, surprisingly, and you know this to be true, your girlfriend, she's done real well raising.
Oh, she's a money machine.
Last month, she outraised the former Massachusetts governor.
The whole pack?
Romney, yes. She's actually from a... Aside the fact that she's crazy, you know, we call her crazy. I know,
she's
love her.
Crazy.
You love her. You love her. But the truth is, don't underestimate her as a fundraiser.
No, she's going to raise money.
She's
crazy people have money.
She's done very well.
No problem.
She's done very well. I mean, I hope she wins. Can you imagine that? No, she'd be a story a day. Kind of like George W.
So then, never mind. Go ahead. Never mind, I'm not going there. You're not digging me, you're not dragging me down. You're not going to do it.
Well, there's a first.
Not going to happen. A little history today. June 6, 1933, the U.S. Employment Service was created on this day. And again, you know, you go back and you say, you know, this is the day that we started creating jobs back in 1933. And yet here we are. We are talking about cutting them.
Okay. Nice report, a nice story coming out that we didn't cover. Nice story coming out of Wisconsin, Rick. I don't know if you heard this story. It's a couple days old. It was discovered that one of the Republican campaigns, our buddy, Dan Kopanky, who definitely has an opponent, her name is Jennifer Schilling. Apparently there was someone in one of the Republican meetings that recorded the fact that what they want to do, they want to run a third-party candidate as a spoiler. And they think what that'll do, it'll cause the Democrat to spend more money and it'll give Dan Kopanky a little more time. But you can bet the Republicans will not go softly into the night on this recall. They will do everything they can to make sure that it doesn't happen.
What makes you think that?
Well, because... These people want to win.
They're such honorable, upstanding people. Good community people.
I wouldn't say
public service minded. High moral fiber.
Well, if I were the Republicans, I'd be worried. You got six already with the possibility of two more oppositions. I would be worried if I was the Republicans right now. Interesting report coming out of the Harrisburg. Supreme Court orders lower court to review Hazleton illegal immigration law. We talk about it almost on a daily basis. Our buddy from South Carolina calls in. We talked about this tonight. The Pennsylvania Supreme Court today ordered a federal appeal court to take a new look at the Pennsylvania city's crackdown on illegal immigrants in light of the High Court's recent decision upholding an Arizona employer sanctions law. The High Court threw out a ruling by the U.S. Third District Court of Appeals that prevented the city of Hazleton from enforcing regulations that would deny permits to businesses that hire illegal immigrants and fine landlords who rent to them. The measure inspired similar laws around the country, including the one in Arizona that deals only with penalties for employers. The Philadelphia-based Third Circuit ruled in September that Hazleton's Illegal Immigration Relief Act usurped the federal government's exclusive power to regulate immigration. Hazleton, which is a northeastern Pennsylvania city of about 25,000, wants to fine landlords who rent to illegal immigrants and deny business permits to companies that give them jobs. A companion measure requires prospective tenants to register with City Hall and pay for a rental permit. Former Republican Mayor Lou Barletta, who is now a U.S. congressman, pushed the measure in 2006 after two illegal immigrants were charged in a fatal shooting. Barletta, who, as I just said, is now a freshman congressman, argued that illegal immigrants brought drugs, crime, and gangs to the city and overwhelmed police, schools, and hospitals. Hazleton's act was copied by dozens of municipalities around the nation that believe the federal government hasn't done enough to stop either.
I agree. I don't think the federal government did enough. I don't think they've done anything.
During the Bush years, they did nothing.
Because, look, and this is where, you know, we get into it with Ike a little bit and some other folks about this immigration thing. You know, I'm not a swing the doors open guy. I'm a realist. In the real world, you've got people who are here. They were drawn here by these corporations who the government turned a blind eye to. I say you have to have draconian penalties against these employers who knowingly bring in illegal folks to work there. Now, the other side of this, though, is you can't have an underclass of people who are living at the margin, who are living under the surface, who are breaking minimum wage laws, who are being exploited. You know, you're not paying a workers' comp, you're not paying unemployment, you're not paying into Social Security. You're exploiting these folks. You can't have that either. So you've got to be able to have them come out. So they have got to have the security of knowing that when they come out, they're not going to be bussed up and trucked out of here. Because if you cannot allow them to continue in the underground economy. They've got to be able to come out and know that they're going to be okay. So at some point, we're going to have to start talking about, and I hate the amnesty thing, you know, you go and you, which is why they're doing the whole pay a penalty, you know, go to the end of the line kind of nonsense, which I don't think is going to work. But, you know, they're going to try and push this. I think you do have to have some way to bring them out of the dark, into the light, and then that's when you begin the organizing.
Well,
and that's when you put the draconian penalties on.
You also have to have a fair system where they have a reasonable chance to apply for citizenship. And, they to encourage that, we have to say to them, look, you can't come in here and violate our laws. You got to keep your nose clean. You can't come in here and owe people a lot of money, and you got to be able to speak English. At some point, there's got to be some reasonableness. And you're right, Rick. It is a complex issue, and people tend to demagogue it. They tend to blame them for all the losses, as has been traditional. Whenever there was an economic downturn, people look to the people who they consider the lowest class, and they're blaming immigrants for a whole wide range of economic problems that they're not responsible for. And it is a complex problem.
Well, no, they're the ones being used in this. And look, I understand it, man. If I were a construction worker and there were people like in South Carolina and in these states where you have no power as a working person, I'd be flipping that.
They are taking good jobs. This idea that all they're doing is taking low paying jobs isn't necessarily true.
Well, but they're taking good jobs and making them low paying jobs. And at the end of it, what you got is you got these contractors.
They're bringing all the wages down.
Well,
yep.
They're bringing the wages down, but the unscrupulous contractors who are hiring these people are pocketing the difference.
Sure they are.
Which is why I am such a fan of prevailing wage laws, because it stops that.
Mm-hmm.
It says, you know, the guy who's doing that job, that's what he's going to be paid. The prevailing wage for the area. And those are the wages that the employers report. So if you've got people who are saying, well, I'm paying my people $10 an hour, I'm not going to report that because I don't want to know and people to know how little I'm paying. What do you expect when the people who are proud of their wages report their wages? You get what you get, man.
Here's Mr. Barletta. Congressman Barlett, and I don't particularly like him, but I'll say this. I think in some sense he's right as far as going after employers. But the Republican Party, the Bush administration, and Santorum, I remember both of them. They had opportunities several times when they were in office, going back 2003, 4, 5, and 6. They had opportunities to put harsh penalties on employers who knowingly hired. And this nonsense that they didn't know, and they showed me their cards. Look, you can make calls. There's federal agencies where you can make calls within several days. You can find out if they're legitimate. This nonsense about, well, I didn't know, that's a convenient excuse. You can't have it both ways. One last comment. If we're really serious, we have to look at the big picture. And what does that mean? Looking at the effects of NAFTA. As you know, NAFTA has just decimated the parts of the economy in Mexico, principally the farming industry, and that has sent literally hundreds of thousands of Mexicans over the border. Now, if we're really serious about going after this issue in a rational, effective way, we got to stop demagoguing it. We got to look at the real source of the problem, and we're not sometimes very good at doing that. Enough said on that.
There you go.
Anti-drilling rally tomorrow. We had mentioned it. They expect anywhere from 400 to 600 people coming in from all over the state. Organizers of the anti-drilling rally say they expect between 400 to 600 people. Based on the number of those who have made appointments to meet with their legislatures and on the buses scheduled, bring protesters from Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and Williamsport. There are sorts of other places where people have organized carpools and vans, according to Maren Arrowitt of Clean Water Action. Celebrity is one of the attractions. Documentary filmmaker Josh Fox, who was nominated for Academy Award for Gasland, will be the keynote speaker. Frustrations is the biggest motivator, said Aaron Watt. The state legislature has watched drilling happen in this state for 3 or 4 years at least and really has not taken any significant action around what people are concerned about. These concerns, including protecting water from pollution caused by drilling, the regulatory improvements that have occurred, stricter standards for drilling, and the toughest wastewater discharge rules in the country, came about through administrative action from the Department of Environmental Protection, not the legislature. DEP recently proposed amendments to the state's Oil and Gas Act that would double fines for violators. That's a good first step. Update bonding requirements and require greater distances between drilling rigs and public water supplies. Now, I understand the administration is in favor of the last, requiring greater distances between drilling rigs and public water supplies. So slowly it looks like we're pushing this administration to do what they should have done a long time ago, right?
Even before they put the first needle in the ground.
Absolutely.
Let's take a quick break. When we come back, we'll wrap things up. This is the Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
There isn't anyone immune from globalization. In fact, the confluence of greed and geography blends seamlessly over all of humanity. As the American workforce has become more sophisticated and smart, corporations have become less agreeable. Of course, there were numerous road signs that led to globalization, and at this point, somewhat improbable that any single cause could be raised from the economic wreckage it has created. However, 1976 may have been a high watermark for the American economy, where a change in the tax code emboldened corporations to move more operations overseas. Where these gutless entrepreneurs once shuttered factories in the Northeast and moved them to southern localities, they were now served up by the U.S. Congress, a world plate, where even to their insatiable greed, the possibilities seemed became limitless. The assault on American workers continued in the 1980s when the Reagan administration further retooled the tax code to allow foreign investors to set up American subsidiaries, thereby artfully managing the exodus of U.S.-based corporations. The unseemly alliance between Congress and corporations offers little solace to workers, but does shine a perpetual light on the misgivings of unregulated money flowing into the pockets of greedy politicians. Unions, while greatly weakened over the last two decades, continue to mount credible defenses, proposing balance, equity, and fairness for workers over the broader brush of Congress that would have us believe that globalization can regulate itself. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Minute is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Your proud defender of the American dream, Rick Smith.
And welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Remember, check out the website at thericksmithshow.com. You know, on Friday, I saw this thing down in Texas. And again, you know, it just kind of, you just have to shake your head and go, you know, maybe I'm just missing something. But again, there's this woman who, you know, was being searched by the TSO, the Transportation Security Officer, who is saying, hey, you know, I'm doing my job. You won't go through the scanner. You know, my job is what it is. So the TSA agent does the whole pat-down thing. Well, evidently went to check underneath her breast, and the woman went ballistic. I mean, the video is actually hysterical, that the woman just was, I've been molested. And I'm going, honey, I saw you. Nobody's going to do that. Stop it already. But she just went absolutely ballistic. And, you know, you got the guy there with the video camera. And it turns out that this woman's husband did the exact same thing a couple of months ago. And, you know, in any of these things, you know, it's gonna whip up hysteria. It's going to whip up people who pull these stunts so they can sue. And, you know, again, you know, this is one of those frivolous kind of things where you go, you know, I get it. You're not in favor of being patted down. Then don't go through the thing. Then don't fly. You know, and this, I loved what the kid said. Well, my mother said she's never been touched in that way before. And I'm going, really? What are you doing here? How'd you get here? If she's never been touched in that way, your father did something quite wrong.
Must have been, you know, Miss Ozzie and Harriet. Must have been.
I don't know. But again, it's hysterical. And the video is just laughable. I mean, the woman is hysterical, calling for the police and, oh, just.
Can I ask you something? Was it a male or female that?
It was a female. I mean, men don't
so
ever.
So what's her? I don't understand that at all.
She was touched.
And your point?
That
of
was
course.
That was her point.
The TSA was doing her job.
Yep. But again, you know, they're looking for trouble, and they were there with the video camera waiting for it to happen. You know, like, you know, it's happening. We're gonna make sure we get it, so that we can sue down the road. Just plain nuts. One of the other things we talked about this last week, just a little bit though, in Orlando, you know, where the Magic Kingdom is, where dreams come true. Because that's where Magic Kingdom is, in Orlando, the big okay. Disney thing, where dreams come true. There's this group who, and I can't make this up, they're members of Orlando Food Not Bombs. They were arrested for feeding people in the park.
I heard that.
Now, back in April, they lost a court battle, which, again, you know, what kind of crazy court battle are you talking about? But the city passed an ordinance. And I'm going, what kind of city does this? Passes an ordinance where you can only get 2 permits per year to feed people in the park. Within 2 miles of City Hall. and you can't feed more than 25 people. So the ordinance is twice a year, you can get a permit to feed less than 25 people. No more. No more than 25 people. If you had 25, we're going to let it go. But you hit that 26, we're going to arrest you. So last Wednesday, they had 40 people. I guess they had this was their third crack at it. You know, feed those hungry people. You know, how dare you? Well, they arrested them. Threw them in jail for feeding people.
Do those people live there or they just congregate there? Do they sleep there?
The story doesn't go into that. These are just homeless people, you know, who are maybe from the shelters or whoever. But there's this group who's saying, you know what, we're gonna go do the whole Christian thing. We're going to do what Jesus would have done. We're going to feed people in the park. Because remember, Jesus did that kind of thing. You know?
I think that's admirable.
So you had these three people who they arrested, and they can face 60 days in jail and a $500 fine. And I got to be honest, you know, I look at it, and to me what pops out is the city ordinance that said not within 2 miles of City Hall. So, again, this is one of those moments where I go, you've got this elitist, snobby legislature who says, well, we just don't want to see those homeless people. And if we can get them to walk beyond that 2 miles, maybe they won't come back. That's how I see it. And again, you know, how elitist, how arrogant.
At a time when hunger is dramatically increasing, I just heard numbers tonight. We've reported these a little bit. It's even worse now. About one in every four child lives with a family that doesn't have adequate food. One in every four. I mean, we better do something about these problems long term. That's going to have a dramatic effect on the future of this country. We better do something about it.
And for those of you who love silly lawsuits, and I love the Stella Awards like anyone else. I haven't seen it. No, I haven't seen the latest Stella Award in quite some time. Used to get them all the time. Maybe they stopped. Stella, of course, is the woman who burnt her private parts with the McDonald's coffee. And then won a jury award of, I think it was like $20 million or something.
But they appealed.
And then they went down the process.
She wound up $12,000.
She ended up with the original $12,000 that she asked for.
But yet when you talk to people, oh, look at that lawsuit. No wonder they want what's the corporate line?
Tort reform.
Tort reform. Ah, yes, how could I forget that? That wonderful melodious sound of tort reform that I've heard for the last 15 years. The answer to all the woes of corporate America, tort reform. And I have friends who say, yeah, well, do you blame them? Look what happened to that woman that sued McDonald's for all those millions of dollars. I said, do you know the rest of the story?
No.
That McDonald's was warned repeatedly. And that on appeal, she only got $12,000. Oh, I didn't know that. Most of the public doesn't know that.
Well, it doesn't fit the frame. Anyway, but in the same vein as that, you have this Philadelphia woman who has now sued Dunkin' Donuts because she claims that when they served her coffee, it was too sweet.
We could make this up, could we?
And the sweetness sent her into a diabetic coma.
A diabetic coma, yep. And she's there at Dunkin' Donuts.
Dunkin' Donuts.
Oh.
She asked for sweet and low.
Oh,
and they gave her real sugar.
That's possible, but why didn't she know that?
One of the spokeswoman for the Dunkin' Donuts said, we encounter thousands and thousands of customers on a daily basis. We don't provide a customer with anything they don't request. If they request a medium coffee, they will get a medium coffee. If you fail to request a sugar substitute, we can't read your mind. We sell donuts, not crystal balls.
I don't believe that. I'll tell you why. Go ahead. I don't believe her charge, and I'll tell you why. If you're a diabetic, you are going to guard religiously what you put in your mouth when it comes to sugar. Diabetic shock can kill you.
I disagree. Most diabetics I know don't care. They do the same thing. So there you go. What's she doing at Dunkin' Donuts anyway? Anyway, so that's our story. That's your laugh for the day. Anyway, I want to thank everybody who came on the program tonight. Our good friend, Professor Richard Wolf, always great to talk with him. Scott Klinger from the Business for Shared Prosperity. Also, Malin Mitchell, the president of the Professional Firefighters Union there in Wisconsin. Always great to talk to him. And also our good friend Mike Crossy from the PSEA. Good stuff. If you missed any part of the program, again, thericksmithshow.com is where you go to download our podcast there for your entertainment and enjoyment. We will see you back here tomorrow night. Have a great night. We'll see you then.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email rick@thericksmithshow.com or interact with us anytime at thericksmithshow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the lunar sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous ray. Democracy is coming to the USA.
It's The Rick Smith Show on Country Gold Radio, WIOO Carlisle, and WEEO Shippensburg.
Wondering if I could just